Product. Are there any other nominations? There being no nominations, I ask Mr. Lewis to take the seat. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming. We're going straight into it, so I'll just ask the secretary to read any. Oh no, sorry. Before we go there, we all have the agenda in front of us. Does everybody, Honourable McPherson?
Thanks, Chair. I'm sorry that Honourable Patterson is not here, and just give me a minute. I actually really want to express my extreme frustration that this meeting was brought forward to 9 o'clock. I cancelled my constituency meeting last night to be here for this legislation. She refused to have it at 9:30. The Speaker on the one hand in the Programming Committee says that MPs can spend more time in their constituency. Chairperson says we must start at 9 o'clock. She's not interested in taking into anyone else's diary commitments at her time, and she can't even be at 9 o'clock. And I really, really think that it is completely poor form, that we are in this situation. I want to express my extreme displeasure at it.
Thank you, Honourable Member. We note that, and it will obviously be in the minutes. Let's go back to the adoption of the agenda. Do we all have the agenda? Do all members have the agenda? Are there any members without the agenda, is the question. Could we have a mover for the adoption of the agenda? Honourable McPherson. And a seconder? Honourable von Schalkwyk. Thank you. Okay, we're moving now to the apologies. Could the Secretary please talk to the apologies? Thank you.
Chairperson, I received an apology from Mr. Mbuyami. He's attending the PCO Energy. Also, Mr. Huber has just stepped out. He will be back in 5 minutes. Ms. Fox is attending a special meeting. She will be attending shortly.
Thank you. Okay. Yes. Before we continue, I just want to welcome the Arts and Culture Committee that are attending with us today because of the matter before us, and welcome and thanks for coming on time. Okay, I'm now going to move directly over to the department, who's going to brief us on the Copyright Amendment Bill. Is it Ms. MacDonald? I'm sorry, it's MacDonald. Thank you. If you could introduce your crew to us, and then you can go straight into the presentation. Thank you very much.
Thanks, my name is MacDonald Nesbendi. From the DCI. Next to me is Michelle Reeves Kadeyashi. She is the Deputy Director in Intellectual Property. And then next to her is Zandile Nkonyane. She is the Chief Director in the area of Impact Assessment. And then the director next to her is Mohadi Matonzi in the same unit. Behind me is Mr. Mkonza, an official from the Intellectual Property section. Yeah, I think we're done here. Thanks, Chairperson. The presentation I am proposing that it will go as follows. I will cover the background. It will be a long background until international treaties. And then thereafter, Michel Rie, my colleague, will go on the provisions of the bill, that is the copyright bill. And then the Chief Director, Zandile Nkonyane, will deal with the impact assessment. And then thereafter, I request that I make a conclusion. If it is acceptable, Shepherd.
Yes, you can proceed. Thank you.
Thank you. By way of background, is that the issue of copyright is part and parcel of intellectual property. Intellectual property is the work of the mind. So people in this time do also have the work of the mind. So in China, the Chinese medicines are a good example that there is also a work of mind. Also the African medicine is an example. So in the area of art, culture, there is a work of mind. So copyright covers some of the aspects. Probably that's why the Portfolio Committee of Arts and Culture is here. So there is a work of mind. So one of the other issues that we can indicate is that intellectual property is divided into, say, two domains. It's industrial property. By industrial property, we mean, say, patent, trademark, design, and geographical indication. So that is industrial property. So, and then later we find that there is what we call copyright. Copyright and related rights. In other countries, therefore, they put copyright and related rights under Department of Education or Department of Arts and Culture. So here in South Africa and internationally, meaning World Intellectual Property Organization, we put the four together, the two together, intellectual property and copyright into one to give us intellectual property. So we will be using intellectual property or IP as an abbreviation. So therefore, the examples are given there of copyright. And another issue is that copyright and related rights. In South Africa, we have copyright, and then we also have Performance Protection Act. Copyright Act, Performance Protection Act. Somehow they were divided. It's like Lotto and gambling. They were divided, but all of them, this is gambling, and then this is copyright. So going further, you find that in other countries, copyright is a main chapter. The sub-chapter is Performance Protection Act. In South Africa, as I said, it's divided into two. This is important because when we're talking about copyright, sometimes we'll be dragging the line into the Performance Protection Act, but we'll be emphasizing the copyright domain. And then the other issue is that in 2013, the policy was drafted on intellectual property, and then somehow there was an agreement to say copyright should proceed. And then that's where we are now. And then these are the issues of 118, and then these are written submissions, and then also we have 122 written submissions on the copyright. The other issue is that there was an outcry from the creative industry in 2009. Officially, the president convened a meeting at the convention center in Saint-Saëns, of the creative industry. So the creative industry came together with ministers who have got a say on intellectual property, and then the issue was to say, why are you dying as paupers? Whereas in other countries, the issue of intellectual property is the one that drives the economy and people die rich, like Michael Jackson, as an example. That was the issue. And then there was an agreement that each department should take, according to its mandate, whatever it can do in order to help the blind, alleviate the plight of the creative industry. And then the issue of musicians was singled out to say one of the cause of this issue is that they are collecting societies. Collecting societies meaning people can come together, like the trade unions in the area of labor, and then in order to form a bargaining power when they negotiate with people who are using their rights. So because of that, the minister appointed a commission, we call it a commission, but it's a study group that was nominated by the minister, and then it was headed by Judge Falam, retired Judge Falam. Probably we know him. Because of this appointment, he became popular and headed probably the Marikana Commission. So this is the same judge that we're talking about. So the retired judge, the mandate was to say, look at the collective management of this right in the music industry. How should it be done? And then a report was produced, and then that report also formed part and parcel of the policy that I had described before. So therefore, the issue of Falam came to a conclusion that there should be certain rights managed as follows. We will describe them later. And then through the public participation, the DTI also unpacked the issues facing the audiovisual performance in South Africa. Internationally, we find that there is an audiovisual treaty. We call it the Beijing Treaty. Audio means, what is it, to hear, and visual means to see. So it's audiovisual. So it was concluded in China. So we are not a member of that treaty. We will solicit consent from the committee for us to be a member of that treaty. So the other issue is repeat fees. Repeat fees, as an example, is when a movie plays, this series plays, say, for a year or two, and then after 5 years, again, it repeats itself, you find that people are not paid. Maybe only the author, the scriptwriter, is paid. The others are no longer paid. That's where the problem is. So this bill would like to rectify that. Through the Falam Commission, as I described it, we say the contracts are so unfair. Let's say between the musician and the users of the rights of the musician. Example, broadcasters. Broadcasters, I will talk about the SABC as an institution within government. So therefore, you find that the contracts are very unfair. Then this commission says the minister should be given power in terms of this act in order to prescribe certain minimum requirements that cannot, nobody should go outside, they cannot be waived with rights. So the issue of accession to the Beijing Treaty, as I said, we are requesting the committee that we go that route. The bills are amending copyright, and then as well as the performance protection. And then in 2010, the DCI Commission, they have already said that the DCI Commission, the World Intellectual Property Organization, to conduct research on the benefits of what we call copyright-based industries. Copyright-based industries. That study was done, and then it was concluded. The report is outside there. I think we made the presentation sometime ago. And then it is saying, as an example, I don't have the figures here. The U.S. as an example, you may find that the labor force of the U.S., 11% of it comes from the copyright-based industry. And then 7% is how the economy grows in the U.S. And then even if the economy is under depression in the U.S., you find that copyright set goes up. So therefore, the conclusion is to say, if we put systems correctly on the ground, therefore the copyright-based industry can thrive. It can go to up to 5%. But the problem is that we don't have it as declared as a sector. If it is declared as a sector, we should be saying the intellectual property domain is contributing so much to the GDP of the country. That will give reasons for enforcement to say the state, why can't you channel the resources for enforcement in that area? Because it is growing, it is contributing so much to the economy, maybe more than the mining sector, as an example. But without doing that, it is difficult sometimes to persuade government, the police, law enforcement to do the enforcement. So, copyright original works are eligible for protecting artistic and literary works, and then comes into being automatically in South Africa. In other words, we don't register copyright in the main. We just write a book. You have a CD. You write copyright reserved. That is enough. But there are exceptions. The video and cinematographic films, those will register. The U.S. has got resources. They register everything. In South Africa, we also have the Department of Education in the area of depositing. Whenever you write a book, you need to deposit it in the central database. There is a number, international, what is this being? International Book Standards, if I'm not mistaken. That is the abbreviation. Then it's a form of showing. It is a form of showing, therefore, that there may be a registration, but we are not asking for that registration. So the duration of copyright in the making is to say it's a lifespan of the person, the author, as an example. So if I live, say, 70 years, and then I wrote a book at the age of that, you find that you need to add 50 plus 50. So it's 70 plus 50. Other countries are going to 70, others are going to 75. So we are at 50. There may be reasons that may be given. As an example, without having found the benefit set of copyright in this developed third world country like South Africa, maybe to extend it may be a problem, but we are putting it to the committee to say when we ratify these international treaties, we may need to go that route. But as for now, we are not making such a proposal. And then the other issue is that the work must be original, reduced to material form, written down, recorded, represented as digital data. And then on this issue is that the copyright area, it also has the digital treaties will describe them later. The duration of copyright, I've already talked about it, and then copyright is transferable by assignment. This will be in writing and signed by the assigner. That's where the problem is. A lot of work of the musician, as an example, of the creative industry, is being transferred wholly, totally, and then you're given one lump sum, and that is the end of the relationship. That's where the problem is. And then they exploit it as they ask, because you have asked for an assignment. So, in passing, the Performance Protection Act amendment bill, it categorizes of related rights, namely related rights as I described, the Performance Act, musicians, actors, musicians, and dancers, producers of phonograms, these are recording companies, who fix the music and broadcasting organizations. And then live performances are the principal means of generating income for musicians. We can argue about that, but statistics from other countries is showing that that's where things are happening. A singer, a musician, dancer is one who claims or performs literary or artistic work. The bill does not in any way restrict or affect the rights provided by any other law relating to copyright. So then there is also the issue of royalties are paid for performances depending on contractual terms agreed upon. As I said, the bargaining power of the musician is at its lowest, and therefore they are liable for exploitation. So I'm using the performance of musician as an example, but I think that is a trend also in the whole creative industry. So let me describe what is called middle time. Middle time is something that came during, let's say, the gramophone period. Those people, some of us, we know what is a gramophone. So there is a head and a needle, and then you need to do something like this. And then you are saying, whenever you, the broadcaster, whenever you play my song, give me a royalty, as we agreed. But because of this poorly drafted contractual arrangement, there is a problem. There is no payment. And then it is regulated in terms of an international treaty, you will see later. And therefore, the issue of middle time, we need to regulate it very well. Otherwise, our people, our music is being paid haphazardly by all broadcasters, and then there is no payment to the musicians. And then what we are requesting, therefore, is for Parliament to redress the situation. So the problem we know. The artists, they may defend themselves during public hearings. They are not organized like the tribunal. So therefore, this compounds the problem. The other issue is that there was a recommendation by the Falun Commission to say, let's go for formalization. Artists are just taking this thing as a part-time issue. Instead of registering a business, whether it's a CC, a closed corporation, small business, in terms of the Companies Act, let it be in so much that therefore you can access some of the incentives, whether it's provincial or at the national level, like the GTI. And then unfair contracts is a problem. I've already alluded to it. Piracy, counterfeiting, I've already alluded to it, to say it is happening, but maybe when we are able to calibrate the economics of copyright, and then we find that its contribution is so high, therefore it is easy to request government to channel resources to enforce. When we talk about piracy, we are talking about piracy, CDs in the street and the like. But most of the abusers of this intellectual property is not people in the street. Generally, the infringement cases are happening between big multinationals, maybe during FIFA World Cup. In Germany 2006, you saw people parking a truck, maybe with a puncher, wanting to claim that they are the sponsor of FIFA World Cup, whereas it is not. And then, so therefore the infringers, if I may use the expression, are not necessarily people in the street. I'm not saying we should not go and wipe people who are in pirating or counterfeiting. I'm saying that people, the record labels, you find that maybe they make a copy, one CD, and make a copy of one, and start to sell it. And therefore, that's where you are depleting the revenue of the musician. Non-payment of royalties by the commercial radio station, and then the FABC as an example. The recommendation was that let's start to pay the legal time from 2006. According to my knowledge, there is a problem there. Therefore, we need to emphasize the issue of payment of legal time royalty. Non-recognition of moral and economic rights of performers, that is a problem. Moral rights, the example is that you can play my song, you can show me dancing, but the moment you distort maybe my head becomes so sharpened in so much that now it impacts on my good name. Therefore, I need to protect on that. I'm just giving a loud example. And then the other issue is reciprocity. Reciprocity is regulated in terms of the act. There is a national treatment, there is also reciprocity. In other words, if I'm a member of this treaty, that I will describe later, and then you find that we are playing the songs of Michael Jackson, and then we take the money, that royalty, we send it to the U.S. because Michael Jackson, we are playing these songs here. Therefore, we find that there is a problem. If the U.S. is not a member of that treaty, we don't need to expatriate the royalty to the U.S. But if Germany is a member, whenever they play our song, we play their song, we must expatriate to the jurisdiction. That is the reciprocity. Then I will describe later the digital environment. But all in all is that these are the bills that are before Parliament. I'm rushing to the issue of international treaties that are going to inform the provisions of the Act, of the bill. There are many people who say, no, what you are doing is wrong because you are not TRIPS compliant. TRIPS-related aspects of intellectual property. There is what we call the GATT system, 1947, I think, and then it came 1994, 95, the WTO came into being for intellectual property, and then we have trade-related aspects of intellectual property. The acronym is not a shortened version of the real name, but we call it TRIPS agreement. It is administered by the World Trade Organization. The World Trade Organization is not a member of the UN, United Nations family. So there is enforcement. We are a member of that organization. And then we have WIPO. WIPO is World Intellectual Property Organization. It came with a treaty called WIPO Performances and Phonograms Treaty. Performances is for the performer, and phonograms is for the recording companies that feed into, say, CFDT music. It is administered by WIPO. South Africa is not a member of this treaty, but we are a member of treaties. So here we are not coming to mislead Parliament. We are saying we are coming to request to ratify the treaties that are informing these bills that we pass. The process of ratification will be a separate one, but we will start another process. The Rome Convention for the Protection of Performers, Producers of Phonograms and Broadcasting Organizations, administered by WIPO, this is the one that deals with the issue of the negligence. Therefore, we are requesting that we should be a member of it. WIPO Copyright Treaty. The WIPO Copyright Treaty deals with protection for authors of literary or and artistic works, such as writings and computer programs, original databases, as goes the legend, and then we are not a member of this treaty. This treaty, the WCPT and the WCT, we call them the digital treaty. Copyright, you know, there is time downloading, internet, all those issues. So therefore, we also have the Marrakesh Treaty. By the way, these names, generally, you find that they are named after the city in which they were concluded. Therefore, Marrakesh is in West Morocco, North Africa then. So even the Swiss Agreement is called Marrakesh Treaty, but for some reason, they are not calling it Marrakesh. It was concluded in Morocco in Africa. So Marrakesh Treaty deals with the blind. We consulted with the Council of the Blind. They say it's not an offense to refer to them as the blind. To facilitate access to published works for persons who are blind, visually impaired, or otherwise print disabled. South Africa is not a member. Here, let me stop a little bit. In this area, when we were negotiating for this treaty, somehow the stakeholders at WIPO, we were divided. We were divided because the African group, including South Africa, we are of the view that to be disabled in the area of eyesight is not the only problem that gives you a problem for learning. I can be intellectually disabled. So therefore, in the bill, we go beyond the Marrakesh, not only covering the blind. The Department of Social Development is administering the United Nations Treaty concerning the disabled people, but we captured it in the bill. So the Bern Convention, South Africa is a member, it protects literary and artistic works. So therefore, in the main, we are saying Parliament is being asked to do things that are happening in other jurisdictions. Jurisdictions, we mean, say, Britain, UK, we mean France, we mean US, we mean African countries like Kenya and the like. We also mean international. These treaties that I was talking about, these are international treaties. We are requesting that we ratify these treaties. This is a balancing act, I want to emphasize. What I have been talking about here, it may not be balanced. I may be biased too much to the position. But somebody may be biased to the recording company. Somebody may be biased to the broadcaster, as an example. So therefore, we need to have a balancing act. But we don't want to see a situation where we
thank you, Honourable Williams, for stepping in while I was at strategy. Thank you very much. Perhaps you would begin at the beginning of the sentence. Thank you, DDG.
Thank you. I was just saying, I've concluded my background. I finalized the issue of international treaty to say, as a department, we are not coming to mislead the parliament. We are requesting that, one, we may be biased towards the creative industry. We may be biased towards musicians, as an example. But there is an issue that somebody may need to emphasize the importance of the broadcaster, the importance also of the recording company. So these issues must be balanced. We must strike a balance, that's what we are saying. And then when we argue, we must produce empirical evidence that in this jurisdiction, this is what is happening. Internationally, as I described, this is what is happening. But it will be wrong to come with wrong facts and tell Parliament to take a wrong decision. That's what I was emphasizing. So I have already said my colleague Ms. Henry will deal with the provisions of the Copyright Act bill, and then I will give her the chance, and then later we will give the impact assessment people to also talk. Thereafter, I conclude. Then.
Good morning, everyone. Just so that we're all on the same page, we're on slide 15 or page 15. We're starting with the issues introduced in the Copyright Amendment Bill. So the definition section has been amended. That is pages 2 to 3 of your bill. As McDonald was talking about certain international treaties, therefore we've added certain definitions to the existing legislation, such as the definition of accessible format copy. If you're in a position to be a disabled person, you would need us to transfer a copyright work into an accessible format. So there's just a list of definitions there, including the definition of person with disability, which is a very wide and broad definition to cater for many disabilities, not only for disabled or blind. Then we have clause 2, which is the scope of copyright protection. It is pages 3 to 4 of the bill. And basically, this is just a list of works that are not protected by copyright. So for example, an expression, as McDonald was talking about, creations of the mind, that is protected, but an idea, just a simple idea.
We all want to apply our minds effectively, so let's focus. Thank you.
Thank you. So it's just a list of works that are not covered by copyright, such as just an idea that remains just an idea and not reduced to material form. This list is also based on the digital treaty, the WIPO copyright treaty. Moving to slide 16. We have introduced, or we've amended section 6. It is page 4 of the bill. it deals with a section called state-funded intellectual property. Now, the state funds a lot of IP, and we don't have access to that work, or we lose that work. So what we're saying, whether it's intellectual property that is under the direction or control of the state, or where the state has funded it, that the state should have rights or access to that intellectual property, where we can have an IP pool or a Creative Commons, and all that work can go into that pool and be used without infringing copyright, sort of an open access. This is also, in terms of the Constitution, intellectual property is property, and we should have a register of all property that the state funds. Then moving on to section or clause 4 of the bill, that's page 4 of the bill, and it is an amendment to the current section 6 of the Principal Act. It is communication of a work, of musical work to the public, and that carries on to page 17. You'll see communication to the public covers all categories, whether musical work, artistic work, audiovisual, and a sound recording. So this is basically, it's digital. It's wireless, how we work on our devices. So we're just adding into the bill how we provide that communication. So we're just legislating on that. It's again treaty language that has just been inserted into the bill. Coming to page 18 or slide 18, we spoke about the problem in the creative industry of the non-payment of royalties. Therefore, in clause 8 of the bill, we have introduced a substitution for the current 9A, where we seek to improve royalty management. It embodies a variety of additions and amendments on how royalties should be paid, what happens in terms of non-payment of royalties, and this is across the board. It doesn't only deal with musicians or the Needle Time. It is also for audiovisual performers, and it is also for visual artists who create visual artwork. Having said that, the very next section is a new clause into the bill. It is the introduction of a resale of royalty rights. So what is this? Artwork is like wine. It matures and also escalates in value over time. And many times artwork is sold very cheaply and it escalates. So what we are saying is that every time the work is resold, the artist deserves a royalty. And we base this on the UK model. Why? Because the Principal Act is based on the UK law, so it was an easier model that was more user-friendly to insert into the legislation. We're also not prescribing the royalty at a sliding scale rate. We've introduced a fixed rate that will be in discussion with after you will consult with the Minister of Arts and Culture to see what is the applicable rate for this royalty, and it will be published in the Government Gazette, affording the public the opportunity to comment, and this will happen from time to time. So this rate and royalties will always be revised. It's also a new emerging issue. This issue is being discussed with the World Intellectual Property Organization. So it is more and more jurisdictions are introducing the resale royalty rights. So it's not like we're the first country to do it. It is happening. Slide 19. The new clause 10 of the bill, which is page 9, introduces a fair use exception. And what this allows for is allows for the reproduction of copyright material for certain uses and purposes, and that means you will not need permission from the copyright owner. You also will not have to pay a fee, but the bill introduces very limited circumstances and it prescribes what criteria needs to be followed for the work to be considered a fair use work. Then on pages 9 to 11, we've introduced general exceptions from copyright. And what is an exception? It's just a flexibility to the general rule. So we have provided parallel importation that has been introduced, and this will be via an international exhaustion regime. And we also just have a list that's not really exhaustive where copyright in a work will not be infringed, where you'll be allowed to at least use a work and you will not be seen to be infringing copyright. Page 20, we are now introducing exceptions and limitations for academic institutions and educational activities. What the bill provides that if copies are made for educational activities, you are not infringing copyright. So again, these sections that we're going through, it's really just exceptions and flexibilities that are allowed under the TRIPS agreement and other international treaties that are allowed in law to make the copyright more user-friendly and accessible to users. Then we also have introduced, right under that on page 12 to 13, general exceptions for computer programs. We are in a digital world, we are in a digital environment. So it just allows those who want to study computer programs to do so without the authorization of the rights holder. Very much so the same on page 21. This is now exceptions and limitations for archives, libraries and museums. Now why this is important, these are very important institutions that have a lot of institutional knowledge and history of our country, and a lot of it is stuck in maybe an old technology. So what this section allows for is something called format shifting. It will allow these institutions to move things from old technologies into newer ones without infringing copyright. The very next section, which is page 15 of your bill, as McDonald mentioned, moral rights, which is very important to performers. It gives them the right for their image not to be distorted. It also gives them the right to claim their image. So basically, it's also a very separate and distinct right from copyright subsisting in the work. We are legally creating an obligation that they are moral rights, and it attributes permission or your ownership to the creators and to treat their work with respect and dignity. Page 15 of the bill, this is a bit of a contested section, it's commissioned work, it's section 21C of the Principal Act. What the bill now says is that there should be a contract between the commissioner, and in the absence of the contract, the commissioner will own the work, however, the creator will have a license to use their work. Then we deal with assignment. We have limited assignment. It's page 16 to 17 of the bill. It's just requirements. We've now limited the period of assignment to 25 years. And the next big section is pages 17 to 19 of the bill. It's collecting societies. So this is based on the Farlam report, the Copyright Review Commission report. It now states that all collecting societies, whether for music, audiovisual, artistic works, or the resale royalty, will be regulated by the Copyright Act. They will be regulated by the Companies and Intellectual Property Commission. All collecting societies are required to be registered with the CIPC. They are only allowed to collect for their registered members because they have a practice of distributing we can't trace funds, they distribute funds of members that are not theirs, and it's just an improved collective management system. Then we go to page 23, which is pages 19 to 20 of your bill. We've just basically, in this section, we've introduced stronger penalties for the infringement of copyright. So if there's non-payment of royalties, etc., we just introduce stronger penalties and some prison time there in addition to the fee. And then we deal with the next section, which is technological protection measures and copyright information system. This is again also based on the digital treaties, and it's just those fancy devices. I always like using the example of Apple. You know, where you shouldn't be allowed to infringe copyright using your devices, which is kind of put the protection in the bowl to protect the digital environment of artistic works, etc., in the digital environment. And then the next page 24, there's a problem currently facing disputes that are not being settled fast enough. We don't have expertise of judges, IP judges. Also takes very long to get disputes sorted out. So what the bill introduces in a new substitution of the Act in Clause 29 and 30, we are introducing an intellectual property tribunal. This will allow access to everyone to the tribunal system. It will also act as a court of first instance. So this is just the rules and how you get into the tribunal system. It's just a whole section introducing the entire process. And then on page 28, clause 32 deals with the regulations. Now the regulations cover a wide range of powers that are given to the minister. It's relating to the contracts that McDonald spoke about, where minimum contractual standards will be developed. Now originally this was only for the music industry because we found a problem with their contracts. But through the public participation period, we were requested to extend it to the entire creative industry. So an example of what the contract lacks. Okay, number one, the intellectual property is signed over perpetually, so the creator or performer doesn't have their IP rights. They don't have a basic right to cancel their contract. there isn't a dispute clause in their contract. So we're not interfering with your negotiation powers, but we're saying these are minimum contractual standards that the minister will prescribe. Do not fall below the standard of what the minister is introducing. So that is just an empowering section in the bill. And then on page 25, linked to that, is there any term in a contract that is negotiated that goes against the provisions in the bill or goes against copyright and what's takeaway rights? Those terms will be seen to be unenforceable. We've also introduced, because of the whole aspect of updating the Act, translation licenses, where, you know, the copyright, different languages, etc. So we're just basically setting out the legal provisos, so to speak, of the different licenses. And I'm just briefly going to take you through the Performance Protection Bill, just so that we can just link up the whole picture. It's very similar provisions. We've amended the definitions to obviously update and to also link to what's in the Copyright Bill. We're dealing with the transfer of rights. It's again the contract issue, which is giving the performer in the Performance Protection Act the right to receive a royalty. That is all the section says. It's page 4 of the Performance Protection Bill and page 26 of your presentation. The Performance Protection Bill also introduces an equitable remuneration that's debatable whether it should be 50-50, but all we're saying is that the royalties, whether direct or indirect, when it comes to performance and a sound recording, there needs to be an equitable split between the performer and the company, the sound recording. We also have introduced on page 28, pages 4 to 6 of the Performance Protection Amendment Bill, we're just giving, and this is linked to the moral rights, we're giving the performer that he or she may grant permission for use of their work if they feel that it is, you know, being distorted or not racially correct, whatever the issue is, they may withdraw their consent for their performance in the work. We've also introduced exceptions and limitations on slide 29. I'm not going to go through that. It's the same as the copyright. It just mirrors in the performance protection. And then the new on page 30, which is page 3 of the bill, is the treaty McDonald mentioned, the Beijing Treaty. It is new because we haven't ever protected the actors in South Africa before. So this is giving them economic rights. There are 4 different economic rights that they will now have. To earn an income or another revenue stream, and they will have moral rights. And then I'll give it over to McDonald to just wrap it up.
Well, thanks. As I agreed, we'll through you request the impact assessment just to give us whether our decision was informed with, where was informed, why are we going this route, and then thereafter I will conclude. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
In terms of the assessment that we did, in terms of the socioeconomic assessment process, which is meant to assess the policy and legislative development process, we looked at the groups and who will bear the cost and the benefits, risks, requirements.
Comes
up. I'm going in.
Oh, I see. I see. It got it as Mr.
Oh.
Right.
Thank you, Chair. Basically, we said in terms of the proposals that have been put forward, there's implementation requirements for the CIPC in terms of the administration of copyright works and enforcement of parallel importation and moral rights, the administration of orphaned works and the registration of collecting societies and administration of copyright for fair use. And in terms of the costs for the state, the establishment of the intellectual property tribunal, and a lot of education and awareness will need to be done to ensure that people understand, the public and everyone affected by these proposals understand what is required of them. And also the compliance monitoring will also bear costs for the state by the DTI and the CIPC, and enforcement, because for instance the provisions on technological supervision and all those will need to, an infringement of copyright will need to be enforced, and there's a lot of the costs associated with that. And other costs will be for the people that will need to comply with the new provisions is contractual arrangements, because a lot of provisions now require that there needs to be agreement between two parties, and also the management of royalties by collecting societies, and the payment of royalties. Now people who would normally not be paying royalties will be required to do so, and for some the additional registration of collecting societies, and also the use of orphan works, because now people can't just use them for free. In terms of the key highlights that we've, in terms of the comments, in terms of the provisions, for instance, in the sharing of sound recording, where it talks about equal payment, we're just saying that the caution needs to be taken in ensuring that the benefits accrue to both parties and not one party accruing more benefit than the other. And for photographers, where the commission works, currently the provision talks to that the only when there's a contract, then basically then will the rights of the photographer be adequately provided for. But it says in the case where there is no valid contract, then the ownership rests with the person commissioning. Then I think it still doesn't give a lot of power to the photographers in that instance. And there's a lot of enforcement capacity that is required for this digital form of copyright work. And also there will be a need to come up with, for tracking the sale of artwork where it's been sold from one person to the other. There will need to be a system for checking and recording who has sold to who, and that might require a cost for the implementation of this proposal. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Back to you, DDG. Yes, Kennedy.
Now then, what is following is the recommendation. I will also talk to the issues that came to the fore from impact assessment. For example, the issue of education and awareness, that we're introducing new issues altogether for people to know their rights. So we cannot afford to produce good policies and legislation, and then we don't go to the public and start to propagate this right. So in order for this right to be enforced well, maybe more than 50%, it is doable if people know their rights. If you don't know your rights, that's where you will hear maybe people just in passing to say, use the intellectual property of somebody, play the music, don't pay the royalty because we are in financial crisis. I'm repeating myself. Use somebody's intellectual property, play their music, don't pay the royalty because we are in financial crisis. That is the wrong reason. The correct reason is play somebody's intellectual property, respect it, see how the revenue you can negotiate, and pass the legal revenue to the owner of the intellectual property. But just to say, no, the local content is too high, and I will talk about the issue of local content. The reason is wrong. So I'm introducing other issues that the committee needs to talk to it, because if it's in the public domain, we approach Parliament to say the Department of Communication, as an example, is responsible for local content. We are not responsible for local content. But because of the Falun Commission, because of the commission that was done for the musician, we found that the local content is so low in South Africa. Because of it being low, therefore, very small, revenue goes to the musician. So therefore, as a tag team between the DTI, Arts and Culture, Communication, that was before division, and then that confusion of division of the department. We met, we agreed, and the ministers had to agree. Therefore, in Parliament, there is a need for the PCs to also talk to the issue of local content jointly. And our recommendation as the Falam Commission is as follows. This one may be controversial, but this is the recommendation from the Falam Commission. Public broadcasters should pay 80%. Play 80% of the local content. And then private commercial radio stations should pay 60%. So we are not only on public, we are on both public and private. Because if we are playing too much music of other countries who highly play our music, then there is a problem. The tariff is also so low. The tariff is also so low. You may find that it's not 0.something%. So therefore, we are saying some of the principal position can be taken at an X level. Thereafter, regulations should follow. But these regulations, because it's local content of Department of Communication and the Department of Trade and Industry, and Arts and Culture, there is a need for in consultation or after consultation, we'll use the correct terminology. So that in conclusion, we are saying the impact of the copyright-based industries can be strengthened, and then therefore we can see the economy growing from that sector. So therefore, the PC should take into account that the bills do not intend to repeal any other legislation outside. There is a need maybe for harmonization, but that is not the intention, to repeal another bill. PC should enact the bills as it confers the right to the vulnerable. The vulnerable people, maybe through the NDP, we are saying it is coming to enforce the rights of the vulnerable. Example is that one of free sale of the rights. Whenever I buy an artistic work here, and then after 10 years it appreciates in value, it is resold. When it is resold, you find that the original creator finds nothing. And in Britain, they are saying, let's come with a sliding scale. Here in South Africa, we are saying, since it is appreciated, let us prescribe through regulation and agree on the scale that is going upwards, not downwards. PC should confer with the communication department. We have already said that the PC should impose timelines for regulation, because there may be a danger of passing this legislation and then the regulations don't come to the fore. So, for therefore, we are encouraging that we be summoned and then come with the regulation speedily. And then coordination and enforcement of agencies should take place, SARS at the borders and the like, and then WIPO, and then statistics, also talk about the issue of the Reserve Bank coming with the economic calibration as a sector, so that we see the value of the copyright-based industries or intellectual property as a whole. The socio-economic impact assessment was summarized there. They emphasized the issue of education and awareness, which is our aim to go to the public. But the issue that they also emphasized, the tribunal. The tribunal is not a new issue. We have the copyright tribunal now shape of the head. What happens is that, I'm talking as if I'm in Pretoria, what happens is the judge of the Pretoria North, what is it, Gauteng, the provincial division of the High Court, goes to CIPC, as an example, and become a judge there as a commissioner of copyright, and then the recital of the matter. But cases are not coming out. There are backlogs, a simple matter that was there took 4 to 6 years as an example, and then we're saying the DTI has got tribunals. It has got tribunals in company law, tribunal in competition, even if the Department of Economic Development has taken over in competition law, and then we have also tribunal in consumer issues, the NCT. So therefore, we are sort of coming with such a structure. It should not be headed per se by lawyers. Economists can head that issue because we're dealing with economics. And then therefore, in conclusion, is that the exception. Look, we are giving the right, according to this piece, right to these people, the vulnerable. But at the same time, we are saying that the owners of the right should not have a right not to allow the public to a certain extent to use this, their right. That's what we call limitations of rights or exceptions. So we are not contradicting ourselves. We are saying we are giving rights through these bills, but at the same time, these bills also limit these rights to allow the public to use their rights. Example is the blind people should be allowed to go to this extent. We quoted the international treaty as an example. So people will come and argue to say, now you want to kill the rights of the right holder. No, that is not the intention. We are saying it is not an absolute right. Allow it to be used for the public good. That's what we are saying. And it is allowed in terms of the peace agreement. It is allowed in terms of the international agreement. So generally, we are saying that's our request, the issue of treaties that needs to be ratified. We have already talked to them. So, Chair, that is the end of our discussion, and I would like to thank you and the members.
Thank you very much, DDG Nancy Tenzi, and the team that you've brought with you. And I know that Honourable Williams would have recognised others here this morning. I'm assured of that. But thank you very much. It's a great idea that once again we are working together with the Portfolio Committee of Arts and Culture. And I really need to thank the Chairperson Tom, for ensuring that most members of your committee would be here with us, so that we work jointly on this issue. Now, by a show of hands, what we're going to do is to have two rounds, and I really would like everyone who wishes to comment or ask a question to do so. And therefore, I think others should be mindful that it's not 5 minutes to speak, as it were. Let's try and make it a start off at 3 minutes maximum per person. All right. In this case, I will start off immediately with the Honourable Williams, going to the Honourable Elbert, going to the Honourable MacPherson, going to the Honourable Mantash. Sorry, the Honourable Tom, your hand is like mine, it is a little bit lower. The Honourable Lowe, you are very welcome. I hope this debut will be the start of active engagement in the committee. Thank you. Yes, we normally, all the committee members sit on the next, so that is quite clear. But also, it's very difficult to talk to someone on the side. Yes. So that is what I prefer, but I did not open the committee this morning. So we have here the Honourable Mkhondo. Yes. Masangu. Thank you. Let's make a start, Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chairperson. I have a couple of questions. Firstly, on slide 10, bullet 1, that the sector is currently not organised, and I just want to know to what extent is the sector organised in other countries. Secondly, with us not being members of some of the treaties, how will this affect the implementation of the bill? I've just got two more questions. From page 15 to page 30, it would be appreciated if we could get more examples, because that is actually the nitty-gritty of the bill itself, and you rushed pretty fast through that. So in future engagements, we want more details along those amendments. And then lastly, you talked about a section, scope of copyright protection, and you said the things that would be exempt.
Someone else got a mic on. No.
I used both. They're both.
No, I think if I may intervene, he has tied two. So I'm going to suggest you change your spot if you don't say.
I can just carry on to the end. So that part about scope of copyright protection, I just want examples of what is not protected. I need actual examples, like for instance, if it's a recipe or, you know, the secret of Coca-Cola's Coca-Cola, you know, that sort of thing. A practical example. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Honourable Williams. Honourable Albert.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the presentation. I think the presentation is too, it's too much of a helicopter view. What we need, I understand what you're saying, because I have a legal background, most of the people here don't. They don't know what the old act or the existing act is saying and what you're proposing in terms of the new bill. They have no idea. This broad submission here is not sufficient for us to understand what you're talking about. So we need an analysis of that, a detailed analysis. I know a previous version of the Act, or the Bill, was very disconcerting in some of its provisions. It might not be in anymore, I haven't looked at it, but there was one provision that said that if an author passes away, all of his royalties would go to the state. It would actually fall to the state and not to the family or whoever inherited. So I'm not sure if that's still in there. You know, these things need to be discussed in this committee. These are very important provisions. Because you're saying, you know, you're going to be working or fighting for the poor and so forth, and we know artists are suffering, but we need to see how that actually unfolds. We don't see it at the moment at all. As far as the treaties are concerned, we need to know whether you're going to liaise with Durco in implementing the treaties. The treaties do not really fall under our oversight. I mean, we have no role playing, or we cannot instruct executive to, you know, sign the treaties and ratify them. Okay, we can ratify them once a year in Parliament, but we can't sign them. So who's going to do that job? And also, what provisions of those treaties are you actually implementing in the amending bill? We have no idea what they are. We have no idea what the treaties are really saying, most of us, we don't have a legal background. Secondly, we don't know what provisions of the treaties will be implemented. There's also no reason for you to stop implementing provisions of the treaties, even though we haven't signed or ratified them. You can still just include them in the Act or in the Bill. So we need to know what you're planning to do in that regard. And lastly, most importantly, you briefly spoke about a RIA. I might have misheard you. But I think a regulatory impact assessment over and above the socioeconomic assessment must still be done. And it must be something that must come from this committee so that the committee can get an independent view that does not come from the DTI. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Albert. Honourable MacPherson.
Thank you, Chair. I still remain concerned that two bills are being presented to us at the same time. I'm glad we took the decision earlier this year that we weren't going to deal with the Performance Protection Amendment Bill without dealing with the Copyright Amendment Bill. But I think that what's happening is a lot of the stuff is being conflated between the two bills, and there's no clear separation or distinction between the two. And my view is that we should be dealing with each bill separately. I think that we need to, as a committee, first consider the Copyright Amendment Bill without having the Performance Protection Amendment Bill trying to influence our thinking on the Copyright Bill and vice versa. Because I think that we're going to come unstuck in dealing with two bills at the same time. So that would be my proposal, is to actually separate the two from each other as a committee, and so we're going to first deal with the Copyright Amendment Bill, and then once we've dealt with that and the House is finished with it, we then come back and then we then deal with the Performers Protection Amendment Bill. So that's my first proposal, and I just want to understand why the department is embarking on this joint bill road. My second question relates to the many submissions that I've seen that the Honourable Albert has spoken to, particularly around the treaties. Can you just advise us how many submissions we received? What were your responses to those submissions, and whether the department will actually be tabling all of the concerns raised in those commission in those submissions, and what your responses were to them in both the Copyright Amendment Bill and the Performance Bill. But Chair, I look to you and for your guidance on your views on this on my proposal to separate the two bills from one another.
I'll address this immediately now. This was a committee decision, mm-hmm. not a department decision. Now let us just refresh our memories. We said there was a need once we realised, having got the performance bill, we actually started with that and realised that there were too many references and there were many other challenges, and asked for a legal opinion on the matter. And it was clearly important for us to deal with the copyright piece of legislation, or at least have it tabled so that we could get an understanding. It would be an impossibility for us to look at clause in the performers indicating that this linked with the copyright one that wasn't even written. So there was that need. We were still at that time in Mark's building. I remember the engagement very clearly. But where your point has got some substance, we said that once we have them both here, and we now do, as you see, we would run them together in the briefing to see the impact and the relationship. And then we would go back to dealing with the first bill tabled, which was the performers. Now, it may be that for whatever the reason, we decide to deal with the copyright first, but that was our initial decision. It also has become apparent to us here that many members of the committee, and it was then apparent, are new in this particular committee. Mm-hmm. And therefore, perhaps many of you were even new in this parliament, new members. We first had this, I think, 10 years ago, is it? When did it come through? So very few of us were around at that time. And there may be a need, but we'll come back to that after this process, to discuss, do we need a workshop to bring everyone up to speed and on the same line? But let's not deal with that side of it right now. But let us then go back to the list that we have here, and that is the Honourable Montash.
Thank you, Chairperson. Whilst we applaud the work done by the department, I still have a few questions. I appreciate the fact that this seeks to address the disregard of actors and staff in as far as their rights are concerned. But I just want to check if the lifespan of the author defines the benefits of the royalty that it's going to get. Why is it that it ends there and it does not disseminate to his family? What difference does this is this going to make? And again, I assume that we were presented with the research not only from one country, as we are doing now, research that we have done in many countries, including Africa, of how royalties are treated. Because I get worried when Mr. Michitenze keeps on saying we don't want to mislead the committee, and that I become concerned. Why are you repeatedly saying so and presenting to us one research on one country that you say we must agree on? Because this is going to be a new bill, its implementation at grassroots level. How is this going to be monitored, its implementation? Looking at the economic status of the department, are we going to employ new people to do the groundwork to ensure that it is implemented as specified? If not, how much will we need to ensure that there's monitoring of the implementation of the bill?
Thank you, Honourable Mantas. Honourable Tom, Chairperson of Arts and Culture.
Thank you very much, Chair. The presentation is appreciated, and we also appreciate the fact that you invited us to this meeting. I think some of the questions that I was going to ask are asked already, and linking to what Honourable Mantas has said, the costing of the bill is very important. You just told us the area where you're going to need money, but how much is it, we don't know. So I think it's not possible for us to just pass a bill without knowing the cost. Because we may pass the bill and tomorrow you may say you don't have money to go out there and raise awareness as you say you're going to do. You don't have money to do 1, 2, and 3. Tell us how much this bill is going to cost so that we are in a position to take an informed decision. And I think also it's important, as it was said earlier, that this committee, it's not the mandate of this committee to pass the treaty, but tell us the roadmap, give us the roadmap towards the ratification of the treaty. Because we can't base the bill on something that is not adopted. Tell us the roadmap. What are you doing now? When do you think this is? So that we have this information that is going to assist us. I think that's very important for the community. And the other issues like your middle time, I think you think that the actors are not organized. I think there is a structure that was set up by the Department of Arts and Culture. If you talk to the Department of Arts and Culture, they will tell you. And I think the process, you know, that they went through to have that structure in place, even it may not be 100%, but there is a structure that is in place, as you speak. they may not all be there, but speak to the
I think that's important for us all to take cognizance of the work that has already been done in other departments and committees. That was the Chairperson of Arts and Culture, Honourable Lowe.
Thank you, Chair. And yes, it's my first day in the my maiden input in that committee, but yeah. I think, Chair, as other members have also raised in requesting more documents, and was I the DDIT chief, right, is made mention of a Palam commission or report and things like that. So I think proper that we do get all of these reports. And that will only inform as to our decision making on the bill itself and the input. So if we can get those recommendations as well. And then as Honourable Tome also has said, make mention of the other departments and other work that have been done so that we can really make an informed decision on it. And then my question is just on page 18, Chair, or slide 18, on resale of royalty rights. Maybe just a point of clarification is to say, for instance, you get those artists that do dust painting in the street, right? And then a big buyer come and buy those paintings, and he goes and resell it. How are we going to legislate that part of those artworks as well, and how is it going to you're going to make mention in the bill itself to also protect those artists that sit on the corner at markets, at flea markets, and they do those paintings as well. Thanks, Jen.
Thank you very much, Honourable Lowe. Honourable Matlangu from Arts and Culture.
Chair, thank you. We should welcome the presentation. I've got a few things that I'd like to raise. We had a meeting as Arts and Culture with Blind South Africa. And when we met them, they were actually complaining about this Marrakesh Treaty. That they had been protesting and requesting for South Africa to ratify, because for them it is a sore point that their rights are not protected. Yet their colleagues elsewhere, like people in the same situation, have that kind of protection. So our view is that government should process this Marrakesh Treaty so that we actually protect our rights, because that's what they are saying. The question that I would like to raise is this bill having, well, I think the issues that are being raised here that the bill seeks to address, we would like to know as to, and I don't know whether this question that I'm going to ask is answerable, whether one can find an answer. Having processed the bill, what and how, I mean, the extent to which the artist's lives will be better, what will accrue to them to make it better? We know when you started your introduction, you did raise the issue of artists in South Africa dying as poor and those in the U.S. as dying as very filthy rich. Value-wise, what is it that we will see of our artists coming out of this bill? Because my view would be that for us to support the bill, we surely should know that this bill will take artist X from this level to that level. And perhaps I must ask this question in relation to the current discussion about the 90% when the 90% was introduced, which obviously was not a policy, when that announcement was made, artists were very excited. But as to whether there is value accruing to artists, something else, because someone was saying, well, the value doesn't go to artists, actually it goes to whatever those companies, collecting companies, or whoever else. And therefore, it still doesn't make any difference. But I think it is crucial that we get to know as to whether eventually this bill will make something for the artists to be who they are supposed to be. You raised an issue about the tribunal. Tribunals work better for people who are knowledgeable. In our situation, we know that most of our artists are actually not quite schooled. Most of them. I mean, South Africa is a natural artist by their very nature. I mean, you can ask any of our colleagues here to do what they know best. It's something that most Africans are born with. You don't need to be educated to be an artist. And that's why, and most of them, I mean, most of them are not educated. And therefore, an institution like a tribunal becomes quite a bit of a complicated matter. And whereas a fora like your ombud becomes better because you can only complain and the ombud does the work. But then a tribunal, you have to hire someone to go and assist you to argue your point, which you also don't even have some appreciation for. Our people just wake up and they sing and they entertain us and they die poor and some people make money out of it. So my view is that versus an ombudsman, what would you think would have been better? Taking into account what I'm saying. The 50-70, the 50 thing, the 50-year issue that you have raised versus the 75 that is found in established jurisdiction. My view would be that protect South African artists to the extent to which others are protected, if I would even accept you even more. 50, why go to 50 when there is 70 that 25 that's working? My view is that let's go for the 70, for the 75.
Right, Honorable Ms. Langu.
Yeah.
You have enjoyed 5.5 minutes.
Oh.
But I did allow you because there's so, you know, you were putting an entirely fresh idea on the table.
Okay.
So if you could conclude.
Assignments? I should. Okay, I have other things to raise, but I can just stop where I was, and then I'll come back with the other things. Yeah.
No, if you would, there will be a second round. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to comment or raise a point in this round? No. So, I think these are all pertinent points, so if you would respond to them, DDG, or your members of your team. When you can't immediately, let us know that you'll be doing so in writing.
No, thank you. I will share the points with my team. In particular in these areas of Honorable William and Dampus, I think it's a fair issue for us to sit down and listen to the recommendations and the examples of what it requires that we can do. There was the issue of ratification, say by Honorable Williams, to say, is it doable to pass this legislation and not ratify the international treaty? Yes, this is doable. We have in the current legislation of intellectual property, we have sections when you just take the language of that treaty and put it into your legislation, you are not allowed to participate in the member state union, where they do the training on the treaties, they do amendments that suit the member states, so therefore they are legislating internationally in your absence, because you don't qualify to participate. So therefore, it is allowed to take the treaty language, put it into your legislation without ratifying. But this is the advantage, building capacity on enforcement, let's say, on the commission of companies and intellectual property, example, they won't be able to participate in that forum. As an example, there may be others, but I've given the glaring one. Yeah. So that is a sort of a response to Honorable Williams. And then the issue on ratification, both for Honorable Tom and Honorable Matango, we gave a presentation on the performance project. And this issue of ratification was an issue. And then a long letter, maybe 3 pages, was written, was sent to the chairperson, indicating what is the roadmap of ratifying the treaty. I think the letter is at the disposal of the committee. So we are still bound by that committee. That will follow that roadmap. Yeah. And then how do we relate to DECO, DERCO, yeah, international trade? We, in that letter, we also explained that there is a chief directorate that deals with this international ratification. Therefore, for us, if we are agreeing to go that route, it would take the language in this bill to say, are they complying with the international treaties in point? They say yes, and the state law advisors, as we did the certification, to say, are these clauses contradicting the national laws, including the constitution? They say yes, no. Then that's how the process will go. And then we come to the issue of the instrument of ratification. Because when you ratify, you need to say, here is the instrument. It goes through this committee. Parliament only has the power to ratify, not DECO. DECO will take it as a messenger to go and deposit to that international director general of that international organization after Parliament has agreed, when we are assured that the treaty language in the in these bills are not contrary to our domestic requirement. Another example is when you join a treaty, there is what we call the issue of reservation. Sometimes you are allowed to join an international treaty, but you are allowed to say this article, they call them articles, this article 1 and 4 and 5 is contrary to our constitution of the country. You are allowed to do that. But the treaty language says you cannot opt out on something that will defeat the purpose of the treaty, or something that will defeat the purpose of the treaty. That is the international law. So all in all is that the roadmap we thought we explained, we also attached a guideline from the Department of International Trade. So it can be rehearsed for clarification. So all in all is that the issue of saying artists are not organized, we work with them. sometimes they take offense, if I may say, to say, to, you say you are not organized. The Falun Committee report, we gave it to our parliamentary officer, Saroj. I think it will have to be distributed. It is one of the source where we are basing this allegation, let's call it an allegation, that they are not organized. It's true that we have CISA. We also have SAMIC under the Department of Trade and Industry. We also have the EXA, the EFTAS within the GTI. How are they waiting with these recommendations of Falun Committee to say, go to your provinces and establish provincial structures? Like now we are going for education and awareness. We need to start from the basics. The basic. We don't have contracts in this province, as an example. But if these structures were on the ground, if the structures were on the ground, we were going to have it very easy. So I'm not blaming any person. I'm just saying it would be better to have structures on the ground as suggested by the Falun Commission, and then we take the process forward. And then when we come to contract, what will Honorable Matangu, what will come to these vulnerable people, as an example? We are saying yes for now, it's a contractual issue. And then these people don't have a bargaining power. That's why the SAPC or any broadcaster, really, that's whether they're paying or not, it's another issue. But the deals say, in particular the performance protection, there should be an equitable sharing of this royalty. In other words, I'm a composer, I wrote a song, the artist dances the song, the performer dances the song, and the recording company feeds the song. I'm talking about the CD now.
Sure.
Yes. And then there must be equitable sharing. According to the bill, as we are saying, equitable according to us, we are saying it should be 50-50. The revenue that goes to the people. And that is not what is happening now. 50-50, say 50 divided by 3, you can get the answer. 49 somewhere there, for example. Then, that is what is going to the people. And then we are saying, the registrar of copyright at the DTI should see to it that when you promise that you will collect so much, let's see the distribution plan. When are you going to distribute it? And then you must be monitored. If it is not happening, the licensing for you as a collecting society is taken away. It is there. So that's how I can talk to at a high level what would be the difference. The 90%, we talk about the 80%, but somehow I'm touching to the 90%. 90%, there was no collecting, there is no edge. That's why it was dangerous according to us. We chose not to enter into the frame. But in some of the interviews we said, let's legislate. Let us legislate. Let us come to Parliament, empower the ministers concerned to come with regulation. If we agree on 90, let it be. But it should not only be public. We said that research of Panama, Brazil, Paraguay, Switzerland or France, and two of the African countries, and I think Masa or Musa then was participating, one of the members was a member of the Falun Commission, therefore who will come with benchmark studies in that Falun committee, and then that's where we say it would be better for us to legislate for local content. But there must be an understanding of the three ministers. The three ministers, not of an individual. So that's how I can talk to it at a higher level.
To clarify one of the issues at the bottom of the room, members of the public are always welcome in the committee. However, they don't actually participate directly in the committee meeting unless, of course, we've got public hearings, public participation, or we have colloquiums. Or when you have been asked to come and give a paper or whatever. So that has been the convention we have pursued. This happens to be a briefing to portfolio committees in the National Assembly. So just thought that that should be clear. Indeed, this remains a people's parliament, but within certain parameters. Thank you. Will you continue, DDG?
Thanks. There was the issue of restate of something in the street, and then how will those people be appreciated, and then we are saying that is exactly what we're proposing, to say you come with a cart, somebody buys it, it's in the business of buying and selling in galleries and galleries. This artifacts, they appreciate a lot. The more they mature, they appreciate. We can give you a list of countries that have got this resale right, as well as examples. So here we are saying, unlike the UK, where they say, give them, because there was in the EU there was a debate of saying, actually we are going to kill this industry. The study was done in the EU to say, no, it is not true that we are going to kill this industry if we charge this retail price. But they differ with the issue of sliding scale, of saying first 5%, second 10%, 2%, thereafter zero. Then we are saying, no, because it is appreciating, it is going up, keep it an upward trend. That's what we are asking. That will give you the countries in the EU, that the economy of the EU never fell because of this resale. That's why, Honorable Mantashi, I'm saying, let us not mislead this parliament and come with the language that gives an impression that what we want to introduce will kill the industry. Say, in this country there was a benchmark. It was the decision of the UK to take a downward trend. In South Africa, we are proposing to take upward trend.
Yes, and what about other African countries? Because they've also got the spirit. We'll hear a bit more about them next time. Right, carry on.
Yes. So thanks. In passing, I will talk to the issue of the tribunal vis-à-vis the Ombuds, Honorable Matlango. We are saying it is true that the purpose of the tribunal is to be very informal, accessible, but sometimes you find that it is hijacked by the lawyers. The experts in legal issues are the ones who win. And this argument, we're also raising it in other methods to say, no, we should have an informal structure. The Umboot, is the Umboot funded by industry? Umboot, is it funded by the industry sometimes? By the parties there? You may find that there are certain issues that may need to be clarified. But if we are fighting about access,
not to be hijacked by experts, whether it's law or whatever. We must guard against so that it must be approachable. And that this example of trademark tribunal and the like are good examples, but somehow they may be hijacked. So it is our duty to see to it that it becomes very informal. The issue of there is this issue of saying the impact assessment should be done by this committee. Is it Advocate Alvin? Okay. So yeah. Then there is the issue of impact assessment. Impact assessment generally, it is done before we go to cabinet, because cabinet comes with the policy and it passes the bills. And then when cabinet pronounces in the May, we take it that is the mandate we are coming then. But parliament also has a right on the issue of the impact assessment. But it is not for us to pronounce that where it should be done. But the assessment that we're talking about and is done for cabinet to be able to take a decision, and then it comes here at the end of the act. It needs to be published in the Government Gazette together with the act and probably with the regulation. But if Parliament wants to enter into that, there is no problem. But we're talking about the one that passed cabinet. And then I'm going to conclude. My colleagues may come with that with some few issues. The benefits. This is my intellectual property. Honorable Montage. It is my intellectual property. When I die, if I have a will, probably I wrote it in my will that it must go to my children. If it is not, if I don't have a will, I die interstate, the law of interstate applies. So therefore, intellectual property is like any other property. It goes to my head. Yes. That's how at a high level I can talk to it. So my colleagues can come to answer certain questions. Yeah, the submissions, Honorable McPherson, they came, I think, the submissions we said 122 and 118. We send it to the Commission. Yeah, we send it.
It has been distributed as well.
Yeah, so
some time ago in January. But do proceed.
Yeah. Yeah, and then even the revised one, we took what we think is good, but we reasoned with the committee to say, please take this one because of this issue and the like. That we have done, if I'm not mistaken. And then the examples of Honorable Williams, I think we will do it in writing. Yes, and generally I think we have covered a lot of issues. Sorry.
Did you cover the issues around the blind?
Yeah, okay, no problem. The Marrakesh, yes. The Marrakesh issue, we took it as a statement from Honorable Mashangu saying that you met with stakeholders, they are saying they are disadvantaged, therefore ratify.
Mm-hmm.
And also the Minister of Arts and Culture wrote a letter to our Minister to say, please ratify the Marrakesh Treaty. We see that you have even gone beyond the Marrakesh to deal with the intellectual incapacity, and then why can't you ratify? The response was to say, we are going to follow the process in Parliament as we are describing to ratify the Marrakesh.
Thank you very much, DDG. Just before you recognize your Honourable Esther Hayson, just to indicate to members, you're very welcome. There is tea outside. Please help yourselves if you like. Have a running tea break, though there will be a 5-minute break just now. We just want to proceed with the engagement. All right? I know that Honourable Mashlangu, you wanted to continue, but let us just recognise Honourable Esther Hayson, who else is coming in, and if any member believes that their questions or comments were not effectively addressed, now is the time. I don't see anyone else other than Honourable Williams, but of course I'm also recognising you again, Honourable Mashlangu. Is that everyone? Have we recognised everyone? Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My apologies for late. I'm just from energy. I just actually wanted to request some documentation for this.
It is coming along now. And then we have Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. I don't know if this was addressed when I was out of the room, but I asked a question about to what extent is the sector organized in other countries and how is it organized? Thank you.
Sure, thank you. The issue of the assignment, the proposed bill you spoke about the issue that people should sign their rights off to the whoever the person, but I go back to the argument that I made earlier on that we are aware that our artists are not quite knowledgeable, and it's easy for them to sign their rights off. When it's happening with people who own art houses, they just give them away like nothing. And they think, well, I can see this one, I can give it $3,000 now, and so on. I think as a state, we have a responsibility to protect people against those situations. And my view is that we should find a way of ensuring that people know, or at least there should be a period where given that the person cannot sign away the rights. But a related matter, you have people who currently exist and their rights were taken away for free. When this act gets enacted, what's going to happen? Are we going to say, well, I'm about to take that, so let him go? Or do we envisage a situation where we say, this act will therefore invoke the rights that people have that were taken away irregularly or illegally? The other matter that I would like to raise has to do with, I know that I raised this matter and the question wasn't very clear. We were proposing that let's make sure that we have a very watertight, forward-looking legislation that looks at, for instance, something that we may take for granted, but most of the 17 million cell phones or more in the country have got ringtones. And someone is using those ringtones of artists for free. Your offices in government have got ringtones. And I don't know whether you do actually pay anything. So let's just make sure that the use of artists are protected maximum. I think, Chair, I should, I think the 50-75 question, I know you didn't touch it, but my recommendation is that minimum 75. And the other colleague was saying, should it for life, why not for life? And after that period, what happens to those, after 75, who owns those rights? I think it's something that you must have seen. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Matt Thurston.
Thanks, Chairperson.
interested, and we briefly spoke about it when you were in the Marx building around the local content issue. And at the time, it was the Honourable Hill Lewis that made the very succinct point that, you know, the state doesn't have the right to determine what we do or don't listen to. And since then, in fact, no less than the SABC interim board has said that the local content policy must be rescinded and discarded. So I find it interesting that even the public broadcaster does not agree with that position.
What is that position again? Just repeat it.
That the local content policy should be rescinded. That's the FABC board's recommendation, the interim board. That was on the 17th of April. And yet I find it interesting that it remains a recommendation here today. I'd just like to understand some rationale, you know, why you're going or wanting to persist with that.
Yes, my understanding was it wasn't the whole policy. You know, that would always be, it was the 90% I understood. But I may be wrong. Honourable Tom?
It's the 90%.
Not the entire, you know, principle of local content. Yes. Right. But I think the DDG also made some reference to that as to where he was coming from as trade and industry. But as long as, you know, sometimes when one is listening to this in one's home, you miss these critical points. And you come in from a kitchen or a garden or wherever or work, and all you hear is it's been rescinded, full stop. You don't know what's been rescinded. Right. Yes, DDG.
No, since let me start with the ringtones, Honorable Matan. In the report of the Phylum Commission, you will see that the recommendation, which is somewhere in the prescription, in the regulations of this bill, when this becomes the law, is that the telephony companies in South Africa, we know them, they have got ringtones. And then the recommendation is to say those who are not paying a royalty, ICASA should withdraw their license. May I stop that? It will be in prescription of regulation. That is the ringtone. Yes. Assignment, if we come with a basic contractual minimum contractual arrangement to be prepared by the Minister of Trade and Industry. Somewhere we said there are issues that you cannot come to the lowest threshold. This is the minimum. Assignment, it can be one of these. To say nobody should assign the right. It would be contrary to. I think we were talking that language. But at the same time, there is the issue of the right of an individual to set his rights. There are people who innovate, like mechanics, patents, and the like, who are just producing patents, inventing, and then selling, not wanting to go into business. It happens. So are we going to restrict them? No, but within the context, I think people have been signing maybe to whatever broadcasters, and then they part with it and they say, where's my royalty? They say, no, next week. Whereas in reality, they signed off. That's what we want to do. What about those things that happened previously? We don't want to mislead Parliament to go retrospective, to go backwards. But there can be a process. There can be a process of saying, hey, Matatini was robbed on this and that. That can be done. Yeah. But this act should not go retrospective. Can I leave the matter then?
sure it's one of the areas we'll be coming back to, given our history, but it do proceed. One moment, DDG, Honourable Manta.
I'm not sure if I'm hearing the DDG way. He's saying the earth will not go retrospective. Yet in the proposals that you were making, you're saying it must go back to 2006. What do you mean?
Yes. In 2002, we went to Parliament for the needle time royalty. And then we went to NEDLAG, delays, the regulation came into force in 2006. And ever since, they have never been payment, just an example. So therefore, we are saying, let's go back when the Act on the same issue came into force, which is the regulation of 2006. So it's not retrospectivity per se, where there was no law or whatever other things that happened. I'm just explaining myself. And then also credit. We said we can go to 2007, when the Credit Act came into force in 2007. What about the Garnishee Order of 1944? It's another issue in terms of the Magistrates Act. Ne? I'm just explaining that to you. I think I'm tired.
yeah, I think you have.
Sorry, I'm finishing. So, organized countries, do we have examples of where, Honorable Williams, where artists meaning creative industries,
yeah,
organized? In particular, Switzerland. In our workshop, we said maybe Switzerland is a military state. You know, they control them very closely to say we want so many licenses, and then this is the economy, and then we don't want to fight for clients and the like. As an example, Spain, as an example, will give you examples. The U.S. will give you examples. Inviting. Probably also African countries, but we are saying in this area of intellectual property, we are all members of the WTO, but the African countries, they are still lagging behind. As they are looking forward to South Africa for leadership in this area, whether it's in collective society. So therefore, some of the issues that we'll be meeting, the African countries may not be appearing. So generally, we want to still request that some documentation, honorable as the agent, I heard that the document was being carried to you whilst we were talking. Honorable as the agent, he requested some documentation.
Yes, indeed. Now, we will address all that.
Yes. So may I stop here with you?
Indeed. As a matter of fact, he has some of the documents already, DDG. But I think that this is the right sort of opportunity to call this session to an end, as it were, to adjourn this particular part of the meeting. But to just remind the DDG, a lot more may need to come back in writing. Just for the clarification, I would also ask our own committee staff to work closely with the DDG to ensure that we're all on track with all of the documentation and put a package together, because these are bills. And before I address how we're going to proceed, I would like to excuse the department, but also I did see your hand, but we do need to conclude.
I'm going to get my answer right.
Yes, this is what I pointed out.
Just ignore it.
Right. No, you haven't been ignored. No one can ignore you, Honourable Macpherson. Thank you. But I want to take this opportunity to thank Arts and Culture. You can see we really can't do this. I really don't think so myself as Chair, that it would be inadvisable for us to just march ahead, as it were, without that. But there is another committee that you have raised, which I know Arts and Culture have also raised, the Committee on Communications. It is very important. We're making a lot of references. You know, you yourself referred to Honourable Macpherson, the SABC, etc., radio, TV, and so on. So there is a need for us to engage with them as well. But let us leave that to a sort of management meeting between the committees and the chairs, etc. That's that side of it. On the other side, this goes back some time now. The copyrights, the performers, all of us in the committee know we've waited a long time for this. And there is a need for us to pull together a package so that we're all on track together, as it were, and to ensure we're on the same track as the department, both departments, as a matter of fact. I think we must also consult with the other department, which we have every right to do, etc. So that deals with that aspect. But what Mr. Herland has suggested, which worked incredibly well, I think DDG will remember, that was 2013-14, somewhere around there, we actually convened a full workshop with WIPO, Geneva coming here, African countries coming here, so that we all got a broader understanding of copyright per se and the other aspects. Now, unfortunately, I think, other than Honourable Elvis, I'm the only one still in the committee, as it were. Now, that's not very constructive. So we can't go and have the same in-depth workshop, but we can. And again, I would like to consult with other chairs who are involved in this cross-cultural issue to see how best we can organize at our own date in which we could deal with this before the public hearings. Our public hearings were scheduled for the 22nd, I think, 27th, and 28th and 29th, the end of June. But as I say, I do want to also consult, say, even if the whole Committee of Communications, Arts and Culture can't come, at least some of the members could work with us in that training workshop that we have, and we could put something together. And then we would also ask the DDG to backtrack on what we did do then and the issues that inform the current legislation, of course. And the issue around treaties is important, as you yourself point out. And we've taken a position in our committee. We're no longer just rubber stamping the ratification. That is out the window these days. We want to know and understand what this Parliament is ratifying. That's got to happen. So I think that deals with the issues, does it, Mr. Herman, that you wanted me to raise. And then what comes back to us in writing, we would hope we can get by Thursday, do you think? Is that too soon? Friday? Quite happy about Friday, electronically. Is everyone happy about that? And the package will include everyone who participates in this particular committee. So if you would ensure that staff have your correct email, so that you do get the information. On that particular note, we will have a 5 minute break, 5-7 minute break. I would like us to start at no later than 5:30 on my watch, and my watch is now 26 minutes past or 27. All right? Thank you very much.
Sitting here, the senior advisor, market, that's not debt, market,
conduct,
yes. I mean, I don't know what's going on here. Are we running a defence force here? And inclusion.
No. Then we also have our legal advisors from Parliament, Advocate van der Merwe, and Advocate Hoorn, but I don't know. Oh, he was with the other bill. Right. And of course we have the DDG again, this falls in the Consumer Corporate Regulation Division, Mr. Nyati Tenzi. Who else is with you? The same folks again, Ms. I will come from DTI, Nokinyana Chief Director, and is it Ms. Matonza? Right. That's, it was here from the DTI side, but we also have the Chief Executive Officer of the National Credit Regulator, who's been working with us, Ms. Nomsa Machigari, and I don't think I see Mr. Sipa Mandla here.
Do I see him here?
No,
you
pull
nuts. Right. We deliberately picked this so that
we could engage with and get National Treasury's comments on this.
Am I correct?
Mr. Herman, yes. And so it's going to be immediately over to yourself, Ms. Gibson, is that correct? And you've really had a chance then to look at what we've done, have you? The relevant areas? Good, then go ahead, please.
Okay, thank you very much, Chair. To extending our presentation, we've broken it up into three parts. The first part is just how we've got to today. The second part then talks to, and what we'll go into more detail on, is the over-indebtedness process, because process was one of the issues that the engagement with multiple stakeholders was one of the issues that was raised in the previous session. Part three then gives feedback on one of the questions we've been raised, which related to our EAO audit and what's happened in that with regard to the government officials, and then we conclude with additional thoughts and proposed way forward. I understand, Chair, that you do have time pressures. So I think the most interesting part of our presentation is actually part two and three. So I'm going to go more speedily through part one, which is really the background. So just to reiterate that we support the process for debt relief. We also, in general, support the DTI proposals, as we had communicated last time, and we spoke specifically to a number of those proposals which we expressly support. We also in the previous session had a recommendation relating to debt relief, which our understanding or reading of what the portfolio committee is trying to achieve is express relief for the poorest of the poor. But I think this is one of the question marks which we have in terms of what exactly needs to be clarified, and we will get to that. The summary then of the portfolio committee's issues and questions that were raised to us were around making sure that the banks extend its relief. It goes beyond just the accounting provision for losses, which is currently happening. It was recognition that the Credit Act is powerful and are we using it most effectively, so what really needs to change. Recognition for the flagrant abuses in debt collection, which now scope the Credit Act. A question was raised relating to the cost to the economy and the sector of debt relief. We need to be very clear about impact on those who are trying to benefit and those who are paying the cost. Recognition of the international case studies, which saw that relief has in fact been introduced in a number of different countries in a number of different ways, and we'll talk a bit to that because I think there's important elements within it. Potential constitutional challenges related to the so-called perceived as expropriation, and the need to balance relief against financial stability, but very strongly making the point that systemic risk can't be an excuse for doing nothing,
yes,
or in fact doing too little. So I hope that summarizes what we understood coming out of that. We then were asked a number of, or there was a request for additional information. we try to break this down between what we see as being the longer term and what we can deliver on today. So a legal opinion related to constitutionality of, in effect, if you are forcing the expropriation. Analysis of the solvency and stability implications of debt forgiveness. I think that this very much would be a next phase anyway. I think what we need to do is have a clearer definition of what it is we're wanting to enact or perform, what debt relief we're wanting, and then it will be within those parameters we can do an assessment of the implications, at least with different options. And then a sense of the industry, what the industry view is. I think based on today's discussion, what we're looking for is guidance from the portfolio committee in terms of what we can then take, both what we can come and put forward to you, and also what we can engage the industry on. The immediate deliverables, what was asked about was how we are engaging with various stakeholders, given what the cross-cutting elements of this, of over-indebtedness challenges in general. So in other words, it's Department of Trade and Industry, it's Treasury, it's the various regulators that sit underneath that, it's Department of Justice, and some elements Department of Social Development, to the extent that it impacts SASA accounts, and how do we make sure that the various stakeholders are brought in. So this is one of the areas we're going to be focusing on today, and the party who's been heavily involved in spearheading that coordination process will be talking us through it. And then we were also asked to share our experience with the public sector audit of garnish orders, and what's happening there and some of the outcomes, which we will then proceed to do. And to conclude with, I think what we need, at least guidance from the portfolio committee, to take it forward. So if I can then hand over to the party.
Are we all on track now?
And we are now on part two of the presentation.
Good morning, everyone. So this concern over consumer over-indebtedness has been an ongoing thing. And in December 2013, Cabinet authorized the Ministers of Finance and Trade and Industry to take measures to assist over-indebted households and to prevent them from becoming over-indebted in the future. And this concern was also raised by the Department of Public Service and Administration, and they also embarked on a project, on a debt relief program for public servants. So with so many government agencies involved, there was an oversight committee that was constituted. Members of this committee are from National Treasury, Department of Trade and Industry, Department of Justice, the South African Reserve Bank, Financial Services Board, the NCR, and the National Consumer Commission. Some of the initiatives that have already been implemented already include the affordability criteria, which was implemented in September 2015. The revised cap on interest rates and fees was implemented on the 6th of May 2016. And the National Treasury also implemented the Garnishee Order solution for public servants in July 2016.
What are you reading from?
If there was a presentation of
So
far the committee has stopped meeting due to having progressed on most of these projects, and currently we're working with the Department of Justice on the Debt Collectors Amendment Bill and the Court of Law Amendment Bill to the Magistrate Court, and I understand that it has been approved by the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee recently. We're also working on the insolvency bill and then revising the insolvency bill with the Department of Justice. So the Oversight Committee will continue to meet as and when required. So just to give a brief overview of the measures that were also, that the initiatives that are expected to be implemented in due course, those are the review of the Consumer Credit Insurance Framework, The FSB and National Treasury have coordinated efforts to develop a roadmap for implementing holistic measures to address the market conduct failures in consumer credit insurance. And the roadmap is expected to be released in due course. In parallel, the DTI has also developed the credit life insurance premium tax. The National Payment System Department is working on a project to reform debit order collections by allowing consumers to confirm first the debit order before it goes through from their account. Yes, I think that's, and then also the project that National Treasury is involved in is that one of investigating the legitimacy of the EAOs currently in the public sector, but we're hoping to maybe if possible to then take it to the private sector to also try and see how they can implement it.
Just what's important also to highlight here is that the, besides the, if you're looking at this image here, is you can see the different projects, both on the prevention side and the remedial, what do you do, the before, trying to stop people becoming over-indebted, vis-a-vis what happens when people are over-indebted. And just looking at who's responsible for what, you can see that it really does fall across these various agencies as is the issue that you've recognised. I think the question then for us is, and again we look for guidance from this committee, is we have had this over-indebtedness work, this oversight committee which has been overseeing this, as partly indicated that has it's now come to an end as it were, because we've seen that these projects were all on track and well developed. And so the question remains, do we in fact need to reconstitute and see whether we need to monitor and measure the timelines and deliverables as we would do. Looking then at the monument attachment orders, just look at this. So, in effect, I think I only need to read the headline here, extremism is the EAO's incentive to extreme action. And there were a number of comments that were made by our ministers and cabinet through the law clinic, just indicating some of the damage that was being done. So the cabinet decision did, that as the party has referenced, spoke about taking action. One of those actions identified was relating to the unlawful, or perceived to be unlawful EAOs. And so government, through the National Treasury, appointed a service provider to, in effect, investigate all EAOs issued against public sector employees. So conducting, which in effect has been an audit. So what that means is going through all EAOs already implemented and then looking to see, testing against various triggers or parameters, which of those were perceived to be legit and which aren't. And then where they're not, to actually engage the credit provider to say, hang on a moment, we think this is dodgy, it's precarious, please withdraw. And in most instances, that is in fact what is happening, that the credit provider voluntarily withdraw. But that's dealing with those that have already been issued. Then the next part is to implement a system which checks for those that are being attached now, or being the orders that are coming through now. And so there's been a part of the implementation process for the system designers to make sure there's the right checks and balances that is not implemented against your salary in the first instance unless it's gone and ticked various boxes. So the solution was implemented in July of last year. Just to indicate that this does fit within the Department of Public Service and Administration process, which the party has already referenced relating to debt relief. Our understanding though is that debt relief process has not really gained traction. And I don't think it's progressed to the extent that it was envisaged. There was some desktop research done, but nothing's actually been implemented relating to debt relief and rescue. The Purcell work, which we've been talking about today, is being implemented. And I think the financial wellness programs have been developed as well. So the scope of the work of what the service provider was expected to do, I think I've already explained
which in effect would say, check the existing EIOs, are they in order? If they're not in order, we need to stop them or come up with a plan to stop them. The role players involved in this have been the various government departments, because of course those are the employers of the, or the anchor employers of the organization, of the employees. The Treasury and the financial systems relating to Pusal, who have to, Treasury as owner of Pusal as it were, have to implement the systems. And then QLEC is the service provider, who has also been working with the University of Pretoria Law Clinic on a number of different issues, including on by producing reports outlining the extent of abuse within government offices. So what we thought we would clarify is not how much QLEC is getting paid, but just in the interest of transparency to show that we're not actually paying, there's no free lunch, so there are costs, but we're not actually having to pay off the fiscus. So because of the 5% collection that facilitates employers, when they facilitate the EAO transaction, that amount is now going to the service provider. So in effect, the net impact on us is zero. But there is the cost, and that's the, what's going to the service provider. And please, I know I'm going through this speedily, but I'll be able to go back to any of the slides. I just want to try and make sure we get through. So the headline results for the period July 2016 to March 2017 has been a saving of approximately 142 million rand directly to employees, a decrease in the number of deductions from 114,000, and I'm approximating, in July 2016 to approximately 84,000 in March, which is a decrease of just over 26%. Of this total, it derives then between the emolument attachment orders versus the administration orders. So you can see by number and volume, the majority of these orders are EAOs, which reduced from 99,000 to 71,000, the value reducing from 52 million to 35 million. Of those are the ones that are being collected. And the administration orders reduced from 14 million to 12 million, and the value reducing from 12 to 10.
Explain so we can see the difference between the administration orders and the emolument attachment orders.
The emolument attachment orders are those that are commonly known as sanction orders. And then the administration orders are where you have an administrator appointed to then pay off the creditors there. Money is paid to the administrator, who then distributes it to the different creditors and also takes a portion of that as it pleases.
To explain the types of termination, so these results then showed the decrease in the number of deductions from 114,000 to 84,000. And these were for different reasons. Either the balance was depleted, in other words, the EIO was paid in full, excessive fees, excessive interest, fraud, contravention of the Dublin rule, the jurisdiction of the EIO was issued out of a court without the necessary jurisdiction, and it goes through outlier amounts explained for each of these. Reinstatement, further amount of claim by the collector should the amount then the act is the request is terminated. So just to explain this, and why I was explaining that is because here you can see this is just the balance of the terminations. What are the most reasons for termination? And interestingly, this picture doesn't actually hold clear when you look over the months. It seems to vary a little bit, but on average, I think this gives a fairly good picture. And you can see mostly on the balance depleted, the consent to stop is similar, and the other big ones are on the jurisdiction of the EAO and the reinstatement. not really sure what the correct term is, but it affected you some of the experiences that were found. So this is looking now at, and I should also explain that in some instances where there's been over-collection or collection that should have stopped but wasn't, and so therefore it's deemed that or considered that refund would be due to the employee, the service provider then engages the credit provider on exactly this, and the credit provider in many instances are in fact willing to refund. So this is one example where the where just one of the credit providers, there were refunds identified to government over a region of 767,000 rand. The question then is, well, firstly, what we expect, then we'll go to other credit providers. This is the next phase now, because it's one thing to do the audit. The next phase is to say, well, once we've picked up this problem, what do we do about it? And it's one thing to stop the EAO, it's another thing to get money back where we've seen it be wrongdoing. So stopping the EAO, or at least getting the credit provider to agree to stop it, is one thing. Getting them to pay back money is something else. And that's not just about getting the agreement in the first instance. It's also, as with all of these things, you need systems to actually enable it. So we're looking to see, we're exploring ways of being able to make these refunds through Purcell as well. And you would think that this should be straightforward, giving people back money, but our experience with, in effect, unclaimed money is it's complicated because there's privacy issues. You can't just go around giving people access to accounts, even if it's to put money back in. So it's something which we're going to need to think quite carefully about. Some of the stats, email and call center statistics, just looking at what's coming in from call center. You can see the majority is coming through on call center and total email. This is just another, these are the types of inquiries. Actually, collectors asking when will you receive payment. Other queries, how can QNIC assist me? How did QNIC stop the deduction? Why is your order team taking so long? Now, this is to give you a reflection on the, what we do over the next couple of slides, is just giving some a snapshot on both the collectors and employees and what people are, their experiences are. So these are the, of all the EAOs, these are now aggregated. And it's fascinating what numbers we can get out of this. So really, if there's anything, if there are any questions, then specific questions which you're wanting out of this data, we are able to get it very quickly. So this gives the debt collectors, so this is the debt collectors with the highest number of, the highest number and value of performance as per judged in the first quarter. So keep in mind, quarter one would be then July, August, September, and it would go October, November, December, quarter two, January, February, March, is quarter three, up to this year. So the highest, the debt collector with the most had upwards of 10,000, nearly 11,000 orders. With a monthly informant would be 9.5 million. You can see how these figures are coming down, so that goes from, or that is not as much as we probably would like. So we go from 9.5 million to just over 9 to 8, which is a much more sizable reduction. I think what this also does is it shows the concentration, or at least the distribution of the collection as well. That the collectors really, that there are a few who are really dominating. I mean, if you take the top three, which goes the number and value, so it goes from, well, actually just the top one, it's got 10 million, then drops to 3 million, and then you come around 1 million and it drops off below that.
So the
10,
the top 10 collectors are average on about around 25% of all the they average about 25% of the total collection.
25%?
It was implemented on the 1st of July last year.
we initially called it the top 10 employees, but I thought that that was probably, you didn't want to be in the top 10 of the employees with numbers, it's not a good thing. So the employees with a large collection exposure, you can see number of deductions, 18, 16, 14, 13, installment values ranging between 1,200 and 6,500. But when you compare that to what the basic salaries are, and in fact what the net is after all of the deductions, so some, I think there's one, yes, you can see, for example, employee 5 going from 21,000 to just over 8, 46, 36,000 to just over 19, employee 8, 26,000 to just over 8. And then you can also get a, you can see an indication of where these employees are coming from as well.
I guess I'm beginning to understand when you said these aren't specific to 10 employees, are they grouped categories or are they?
No, they are actual employees. They are actual employees. So where you see employee name, there would actually be an employee name. We can see who they are for privacy reasons. The next slide looks at the departments with the largest collection exposure, and as I'm sure you could have hazarded a guess at which ones they are. The South African Police Service, Departments of Education, Departments of Health, Correctional Services, both at the national and the provincial level. But the most egregious being a couple more examples we said about, and this is just showing you some of when the service provider goes through the audit, these are the types of things that they're picking up. So this is an issue on jurisdiction. You can see the magistrate court in Bloemfontein, but it's being dealt with in Kimberley. The 5% amount, in other words, this in here, the installment of 300 grand is being paid, and that 300 should go fully over to the lender or the debt collector. But in this instance, the 5% is actually being taken off, and so the full amount is not reflecting as that they've paid it. The current legal focus of the service provider is on fraudulent EAOs. They've picked up a number of cases where this isn't now an instance where the EAOs are issued wrongly, as in wrong jurisdiction. There actually just isn't an EAO at all, or we can't find evidence of it. So when you try and track the case number, it doesn't exist. Or when you look at the court files, the files relate to completely different parties. And then similarly with deregistered collectors. So these are areas that the service provider is now getting into to try and unpack more wrongdoing. We should also highlight that, as I indicated, most credit providers, when we picked up these problems, are actually willing to come to the parties and say, okay, fine, we've done the wrong thing, they'll fix it voluntarily. There are a couple of credit providers who are not doing that. Those cases are going to go to court, and we will be the relevant, we're going to be pursuing those matters, but because it is going to court, we can't talk about it. So I think now what we are, as I indicated up front, is I think there's a lot that can be done. I think the question is for us to work out exactly what that response is, or to help support the portfolio committee work out what that response is. There are a couple of things which need to be outlined. So the first is, who should benefit? And this thing we're talking about, we need to find some clear parameters between what we heard the last time being the no income, no assets, the poorest of the poor, the indigents, or these very low income, vis-a-vis maybe low income, low assets versus low income, low assets. And the reason why we're asking this is because the preferred or the recommended intervention might, well, the expectancy look quite different. So if we unpack the feasibility study a bit more, and we look at what different countries have done, those country responses will be subject to whether you're wanting to write off the debt completely or whether you're wanting to restructure the debt, for example. So if we're talking about very poor people you can't afford at all, you should not have got the loan, that's a write-off. If you're talking about, like for example in the US, there were students or people who maybe could get the loan, they've got income, they will have an income in order to pay it, but the balance of that is just misplaced at the moment, they're not insolvent. That's more a restructuring issue. Also then the question of public policy objectives. So first is the borrower circumstances. Who are we trying to improve? The second issue that we pinpointed is what are we trying to achieve? What are our direct policy objectives? And it doesn't only need to be one. I mean, there might be more than one, but I think that in turn implies what it is our response would be. So for example, is this purely a social protection mechanism? In which case, we would then not be talking about teachers and those staff persons. If, however, we say, yes, it is the indigent, but it's also heavily strained persons as well, like minors, for example. In the US example, I think they reached out to teachers and they implemented a plan specifically for teachers. That then, again, would have a slightly different makeup or a different mechanism. Depending on how we set these parameters, so we can then look to different relief mechanisms, whether it's writing off, a restructuring, also the difference between whether it's, like I think the Fresh Start program, they structure slightly differently. Some are just on loans and credit, some actually go more and it's actually they're considered debt as a whole. And that then would bring a different role play depending on where it goes. The India example was writing off debt, but again, collateral. So that was actually the collateral of land. So it wasn't a straight write-off, even though the implication actually was the same. So there's some interesting questions for us here, and it's also not to say that we can't do both. I mean, we could actually look at the indigent, but then at the same time, you've got mine workers who have a pension, they can't access the pension, and yet they're sitting with a really high debt. So is there an opportunity whether on a one-off on an ongoing basis to maybe have an exemption or an exception to the standard requirements where we would be able to use that maybe up to a 25% to pay off your debt? I think what's important here though, and what has come up over our discussions, is that we need to be very careful of moral hazard. So whatever we do, we need to recognize that there's moral hazard on both sides and there's opportunism on both sides. So what we need to try and do is change behavior. And the behavior is the behavior of lenders who lend badly in the first instance and the behavior of borrowers who borrow recklessly as well. I think these things can definitely be managed. So for example, the way in which we would consider about the behavior is that if you're voluntarily coming into the system, you should not necessarily be able to then borrow unsecured debt or over a set parameter. But these are more the mechanics and these are almost the next step things. Once we've outlined, once we've got a clear view of what we're trying to do, then we can mitigate those other risks. But it's very important that we first identify what it is that we're trying to do and we come up with the process around that. So in conclusion, I think what's very clear from not only our experience up until now in terms of the over-indebtedness process and some of which we've highlighted is that coordinated action is necessary because there are different regulators, there are different agencies involved over these different entities who would be coming into this. I think it's also important to highlight that the regulatory environment, of course, from the financial side, from the treasury side, is also changing. So where we don't have powers yet, through the Twin Peaks framework, we will have more powers. So, for example, over debt collectors. Debt collectors are in fact brought under the Twin Peaks framework as well. I think very, and back. So, very much our intention going forward is to be making sure, and this goes into my next bullet, when we're talking about mapping out for the typical South African debt chain, that I think what we need to do collectively is that, and I think part of this has been done, but there are different persons, different people, different South Africans in different circumstances. Just like I pointed out, some have assets, some aren't. Some are insolvent, some aren't. Some are liquid, some aren't. Some can afford debt counseling, some can't. But there's only a finite number of options. And what would be very useful, I think, for us to actually map out for a South African, who is that South African, and what are, if depending on these different options, where do they go? And then we can see if there are gaps and if there are not gaps. And what, and I think a lot has been addressed, particularly through the DTI and the credit regulator. But I don't think we've quite got that mapping exactly right, and I think it would be a useful check in any event. And what that means also from us from a regulated side, if we look at the banks, we also want to make sure that across that chain, right from the original lending through to the holding of the loan, the non-repayment or non-repayment, you also then need to get what happens next. Is that debt unsolved? How is it unsolved? Where does it go? How does it enter into the court system? What happens when it's in the court system? I think from the bank's perspective, when we're looking from a conduct perspective, we're going to be looking at that full chain. And we're going to make sure that, for example, the bank, you can't just unsolve debt. You have still will have responsibilities relating to how that debt is unsolved. The systematic monitoring and evaluation of interventions is critical. I think we, and this is, I can say from a treasury perspective, this is something we can do better. And I mean of treasury, I think we can do better of our own monitoring evaluation of our interventions. And we need to find a way of doing this more systematically, particularly in terms of outcomes. Because it's one thing to introduce something, but if we're not monitoring what the effect has been, and we're not systematically getting the reporting on that, we might be feeling great about ourselves because we've taken the step, but is it actually working and are the people really feeling the results? Our proposed way forward, just to remind that, or just to recall that we came back with some information today, but there was other information that's been requested, which given the time period, I think we're a bit tight. But I think even the data, even before the data, what we'd very much like is to get some guidance on those parameters. What exactly the portfolio committee is, just some of the elements that we've outlined today about who's the target beneficiaries, and it could be more than one. The indigent plus mine, low income, no assets, low income, low assets. But if we at least have some specific guidance on that, we can then, at least from a banking perspective, be coming with options for the parameters of a solution. And on the basis of that, we would be able to engage industry as well and see what's possible. And by what's possible, I don't mean we're waiting for them to volunteer. I think that we can then be sitting on our own research as well to see how do we get that balance right of making sure we've got the right impact and maximum impact. We have spoken about a joint action plan between the Commission and the DTI, just recognising that there are different regulated entities involved. And I think on the basis of once we have clear parameters, at least options, what we'd like to do is come back to you with options on the solution. And then once we've got those options on the table, we can also, on the basis of those options, do more of an impact assessment, and then be developing that impact assessment as we get clearer crystallization of what exactly that framework would look like. And lastly, just to highlight, again, not to forget that there are other important reforms that the DTI is proposing, or did propose in terms of its policy, and we think those shouldn't be overlooked as this other process continues.
Yeah, I think that's very important. It's not actually stated here, but it's good of you to mention it verbally, because there are these other points, as you say. I'm just going to thank you very much, Ms. Gibson. That was very succinct. And also, just to make sure you've got it right, Mr. Nikondela, is it? Is it Nikondela? Nikondela, thank you. Right, I see the Honourable Hill Lewis. That's the only hand I see on the list. Right, the Honourable MacPherson, right, the Honourable William, the Honourable Elvis. Is that where we are? Right, do go ahead.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and the presenters for an interesting presentation. There's quite a lot I want to follow up on. Firstly, on the program that you run in Treasury, I think it's a great program. It shows what is possible given our existing toolbox. I was frankly surprised that there's only 85,000 garnishee orders in the entire public service. I presume, though, that this is only national and provincial staff and doesn't extend to local government staff at all, which would be another significant number, I'm sure. But just some follow-up questions on that. Firstly, when you see staff members of the state with, in one case, 23 garnishee orders for one staff member, is there a follow-up intervention with staff members like that, some kind of counselling or training on responsible financial management? The wonderful thing about this data is you can actually see all 85,000 staff members of the state who are struggling financially and who are getting into too much debt. I really do think that there should be a follow-up program where you make contact with those individuals and say, can we help you as Treasury to better manage your monthly budget, to better understand your financial planning duties as a breadwinner in your household? I think that could help a lot to prevent these people from getting back into debt in the future. Secondly, the names of the top 10 debt collectors, I understand why you have to withhold the names of the employees, but I don't understand why you withhold the names of the top 10 debt collectors. I would like those names, if you could give them to us, please. I would like, if possible, to have some of them in this committee so we can ask them to explain how it is possible that they can have this many illegal garnishee orders against state employees. And then you said that some of them are going to court against the credit providers, I understand. But you also have to take action against the collector, because it's the collector that has entered into the illegal garnishee order, not the credit provider. The credit provider has unsold the debt to a collector, and the collector has gone and got the garnishee order. That's how it works in most of the cases, 85% of cases. So, number one, have you laid complaints against with the Law Society against all of those attorneys in every single one of these cases? I would like to see whatever the reduction is, 20,000. There should be 20,000 complaints going to the Law Society against those attorneys for this kind of behaviour, and hopefully they can be. Well, all of these illegal garnishee orders should result in complaints to the Law Society against those attorneys, and then if need be, there should be criminal complaints as well for this kind of behaviour under the Stellenbosch Law Society precedent. Then the information I hope is being shared with the regulator sitting behind you, so that she can see and her team can see exactly who these debt collectors are. Obviously, the NCR is not the regulator of debt collectors, but there should also be a way to get these, to get debt counsellors in touch with these people so that we can make sure that they are rehabilitated as lenders in the economy. So those are just some follow-up questions on that project. I understand it's a great deal of admin and hard work, but I think that is the only way to actively and effectively achieve debt relief in these. There's no easy win, there's no easy victory or silver bullet. It is by going through all of these things one by one and finding the illegal ones. The same is true, for example, in the audit that's being done on African Bank's bad book. There's 3.2 million credit agreements in that book. Now that is an enormous amount of paperwork, and I'm sure that audit is going slowly but surely. But you can only imagine if you found a kind of illegal rate, if I can call it that, of about 3-3.5% on the state's employee on the personal system. Even if we find 3.5% of those 3.2 million credit agreements are illegal, that is massive debt relief. And that is why I'm such a big fan of using the power that the Act gives us. It might be a hard slog, but using the power that the Act gives us to achieve debt relief. 2 weeks ago, the regulator won an incredible victory against Edcon on illegal monthly club fees of 60 rand a month, which yields a saving. I was staggered to see these figures, 550 million rand a year that Edcon was charging consumers in those 60 rand a month fees. Now that's half a billion rand in debt relief, that's what it is, because of a victory using the powers that the Act already gives us. So again, I know I'm a stuck record, but I'm a big fan of what you've done in the personal system and cleaning it up. And I believe that there are ways that we can look at expanding that across the economy, in the private sector as well, in local government as well, and achieving real, sustainable, impactful debt relief.
Okay, thank you very much, Honourable Hill Lewis. Honourable MacPherson.
Thank you, Chair. I think it's proving incredibly useful to have National Treasury with us for these discussions about debt relief, because it just keeps zeroing in the focus into, I think, where we should be going when we're talking about this very important matter. I want to focus in on slide 29, and I'd like to understand where you are with with your focus or understanding of the fraudulent EAOs is. Have you compiled a list of the, sort of the 10 worst offenders of who have created these fake EAOs? Do you have a list of deregistered collectors that continue to collect under false pretenses? Because I think it would be really important that we're furnished with that list, and then understand what criminal action has actually then been taken, against these people. Because if they're continuing to obtain these fraudulent EAOs, we need to understand what has the FAPS done about it, what is the Department of Justice doing to root out these people that are issuing them in the name of the court. So have you got some idea, or have you got a list? And if so, can we please have that so we can look at it?
Thank you, Honourable MacPherson. Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chairperson. I want to welcome the input from National Treasury. National Treasury, on their slide 30, were asking questions that we still in the committee haven't come up with absolute definite numbers for instance, who's going to benefit from this, which group of people. So the information we requested from you previously is very important for us. And I don't know if we asked for this previously, but I think we definitely need information on where is the debt. In other words, then, is the debt 10 people with 100 million rand debt each, or is it a million people, 5 million people with 5,000 rand each? In order for us to aim our debt relief at the right group of people so that we can have the biggest impact. So these questions, you're almost saying to us, we can't answer your questions, committee, until you tell us who you're aiming at. And we're saying, well, we don't know who we're aiming at until you give us the information. So it's a bit of a catch-22, but we need to somehow get round that so that we can have better understanding of where we can make the biggest impact on the indebted South Africans, but also I'm not saying no impact on the banks, but with a reduced impact on the banks. So we really need that information from you for us to identify who exactly it is that we're going to give debt relief to. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Williams. Honourable Elbert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just two short questions. It's a laudable thing that we're trying to achieve, but it's a difficult objective. And I was wondering if there's any behavioral science evidence or research that can show what will happen when you give debt relief to people. Will they just go into more debt again, or will they actually learn a lesson and act more responsibly in the future? So, you know, as you also do your own research with regard to certain types of taxes and the effect that it will have on behavior, I think one would need to understand what the behavior of people could or should be, you know, taking when you take this course of action. Then secondly, you've taken some important points on how to deal with debt relief and also regulation. There's an aspect, I'm trying to find it now, where you deal with cabinet-approved measures and remedial measures. I think there's another important point there that we don't see. We know that the Ndupem rule is going to be addressed, but what we don't see is the conduct during auctions. You know, when assets are taken back by the bank or whoever the institution might be, they tend to rig those auctions and sell those assets at a very, very low price, which leaves the debtor still indebted and with no asset. And I think that is something that needs to be addressed very urgently. Before I came to Parliament, I was a legal practitioner myself, and I've seen with my own eyes how banks manipulate the system and how they sell off assets at a very, very low price to the advantage of their friends or whoever is going to benefit. Normally, an internal circle in the bank that makes sure that the auction works out in a certain way. And we must put some sort of a measure in there that there must be a reserve price, that you cannot sell lower than real market value. If that happens, it should be illegal and the auction should be illegal. I think we must protect people who are indebted in this way, because then they know at least if the house is sold, it will probably extinguish the debt and they will be released. If it doesn't happen, then they keep on paying for something they don't have. Thank you.
Yes, I'm glad you raised that again, Honourable Albert. You will recall that you raised this much earlier on when the whole issue of debt came up, I think 6-7 years ago, and it hasn't been addressed even yet. And that may be something that we do need to factor in here. We cannot allow these financial institutions of one kind or another, retailers, to, you know, break the law or the purpose, the spirit of the law, with impunity. And as legislators, we need to look at that. It affects everyone who has people in their party. And I take it we don't have robots yet. So fourth industrial revolution hasn't quite reached that, has it? But honourable members, I think that's all of you who wanted to comment or raise a question. Mark, Chris, honourable Tierko.
Sorry, Chair. It's not for me to discuss it. So I think I need to ask the treasurer if this flat status, we are saying the U.S. has highlighted this by saying teachers, they gave teachers incentives. So what are we saying ourselves? Do we have to pilot to a certain, maybe educational policy as South Africa, so that we start somewhere to say this is where we start, this is how we're going to intervene, and let's see as South Africans, are we winning on that part or is it not working for us?
Thanks, Honourable Tioko. Honourable Lowe.
Thanks, Chair. Sorry to come in so late. Just have to also, like, just find my feet, so I just don't hit my name with the blank here. On slide 13 or page 13, I think the question has come up earlier on as well. But I want to take it a bit further as to, have any research been done of the
top 10 employees, like, are they male, are they woman, and then are they, in which race are they, the black people and so forth. That is also important if we're going to, in order to assist us, Chair, with what we are needing to do. So that is just a question that I, of interest, say, are they women, and then as well the race thereof. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I have a couple of questions myself. The, you know, if you look at your slide 25, Department of Higher Education comes up, etc. I don't know how many teachers are involved, because there are a couple of education departments here. And it's a well-known fact that a number of teachers eventually can't cope any longer and resign in order to get their pension to pay off their debt. And of course, the policy of government is not to encourage people to sell off their pensions and utilise them. We're encouraging them to retain these pensions. So that becomes a problem. The other issue is when you look at the number of, somewhere here we saw about members of the police force and correctional services, you know, there used to be a point that, you know, if somebody is working in a finance department with cash and they've got sticky fingers, it can be quite a challenge. Now, the thing is with police, you know, their position that they carry out with such authority, you don't want to lay them open to bribery, etc. And that is another pressure that they may have. And we do need to tackle it. On a positive note, you've done this with public sector employees, all right? But I do think, honourable members, that outside in the private sector, there are some huge companies, even medium-sized. Why aren't they doing it? Why aren't they being proactive and looking at it? The mining companies, the steel companies, and so on and so forth. So I think this is one area where the public service appears to be leading the way. Thank you very much. Honourable Hill Lewis?
Sorry, just one point of correction, Chair. When we did have the colloquium, the Chamber of Mines has done this for South African mining companies and they had amazing success.
Yes, thank you for reminding me.
Okay, thank you very much. I think what I just mentioned on the end, on the emissions first, is that there's a lot in this data, and I think what will be, and I appreciate you prompting it, but the thing, this also goes to the issue of the, do you get the data first or do you get the parameters first, is that, I think if I'm understanding it, putting these together, what we can do is, by ourselves, from outside, we can create buckets. So we can create categories of persons, if you talk about that. And then all those categories of persons, we can then create parameters, so they'd be hypothetical. And then we can, there's probably a lot of information here, at least we can be looking at the public sector, because that's, we've got all the data, so that we can, once we've worked out what we want, I think it will be easy to then, even for the public sector, be doing an analysis of income distribution and other distribution by other demographics. So I think that would be a very useful starting point. I think we can also probably do that with the banks, with the banking sector. That will be a little bit longer because we don't have the data right at our fingertips. The issue though is that I need to think about it myself a bit more is, as you've spelled out, the banks themselves are one piece, but there's a lot that's happening around the banks. So we'll be looking at the public sector, we can probably get the information quite readily. But when you're looking at the banks, there's going to be the banks, and then there's the non-bank providers, and then there's the debt collectors, and then those others that are involved in the chain. And that's going to need a different process, I think, in terms of trying to unpack those effects. going back more than to the specific question, the audit numbers, to just remind as well that the audit is not concluded yet. So we are also working through. I think it's a very good point around what are we doing when we find that these lots are humans overloaded and what other interventions. And particularly, as we know, the DPSA has also set up the wellness program. It does make sense, and sometimes we are blind to our own effectiveness, that we need to get these dots together. And the institutions are there, the programs are there, we just need to connect them, and so thank you for that. Why we withheld some of the information, the party was actually saying, no, we must put it out, we must put it out there, and who are these debt collectors? Being the ultra-conservative government official that I am, I'm like, no, I think we can just need to check that we are actually allowed to make that information available, and we'll make that information available. Just a point on the debt collectors, we're not talking about credit providers. I'm sorry if I've used, it's credit providers and debt collectors, so we are also referring to the debt collectors and practices. So complaints to the Law Society, this has been an interesting one because we're actually engaging the Law Society in actually what the role of the Law Society is. Because the Law Society sees itself as a regulator, but it's actually very conflicted because it's a regulator and it's an industry body. So it's trying very hard to play both sides of that game, and my personal view, not the official press review, is that I'm not convinced it's doing that very well. I appreciate, yes, we should be, and we'll share what we have with the credit regulator. We have I should also say up front, we have been engaged with the credit regulator in terms of the broad results, but we haven't seen through the specifics of the underlying data. So the credit regulator is aware of the work that we're doing. The additional list of information, I think what I would request, we've obviously taken the notice of what was requested in terms of the lists of, I think, the fraudulent data, what the numbers are there. We can get that, but I'd like to obviously keep the invitation open and maybe just give some thought to specific and we'll coordinate to say what are the other questions that you have? Because I'm sure you're not going to have all your questions now. So in terms of the data, what would you like seeing us taking out of the data? And we'll then get to that and resubmit back to you. The behavioral research, I think, is very important. Because again, this is what's really important is that we change, again, the behavior of the lenders and the borrowers. And how do we get people out of the wrong habits? So I think that's something which we need to give some consideration to even from at least as a starting point on a desktop basis, look at the behavioral work, because there's evidently going to be behavioral work that's being done on this area, given that it's such a hot topic internationally as well. So thank you for that, we will follow up. The conduct of auctions is a complicated one, because when you see the outcome of someone's house being sold for a ridiculous price, that's obviously wrong. However, it doesn't, I think some of the complexity we have in trying to understand the issues here and where the barriers are, where the problems are, it is not as simple as it seems. So, yes, I think the banks were notorious for a long period, but while there's been, since there's been so much scrutiny, they've obviously tightened up their game somewhat
with the kitchen.
Yes. But even within that, so there are a couple of the banks, not all the banks do this well, but some of the banks are trying to do the right thing. And they will actually, they've got their in-house, almost an auction mechanism, where they will sell, not auction, but you can go, you volunteer, and say, listen, I'm in a problem now, I can't make my repayments. Please help me. They only facilitate to make sure that you get linked up with an agent who will sell your property at market value, make sure you get a good price. The problem is, and this is where the behavioral work comes in, is that people they don't want to admit that they've got a debt problem. So the experience has been in some instances where people aren't wanting to come forward to volunteer to have their house auctioned off. So it almost pushes to that point where it gets to almost a compulsion. The only absolutely everything, even though we might sometimes want to. And I think that in terms of Honourable Member Turker, you had spoken about a pilot. I think that's an excellent idea. I think we can explore what that would mean. And I think then, thank you, Chair. We've covered all the issues, and we will be around to ask you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, and I appreciate you, and I'm sure so does the NCR, appreciate the point that you've made, that you need to share more detail on what you've done. But I know Ms. Matsugari would like to come in. Before you do, we can maybe just have Advocate Van der Merwe just commenting, and then you've got the floor is yours then.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe just on one or two issues. I know that there was a request to look at reporting of this behaviour from creditors to enforce emolument attachment orders that weren't obtained legally and so on. Probably with that you can also look at creditors' behaviour and so on. What we must just keep in mind is that not everything that is frowned upon that the creditors do are currently illegal or criminal in nature. So definitely where an attorney especially has, or in fact anyone in an occupation that is regulated has acted in an absolutely unethical manner, that must be reported. And I think that is definitely something where we can look at. I'm sure the Law Society will not look very kindly upon attorneys who have been doing these collections with orders that are questionable, because an attorney at least should know when an order is. I mean, looking at the picture that we were given, I could see a number of things wrong with that order, and an attorney should question that. But for instance, things like the reckless lending and those, that's not criminal at the moment, so those will only be reported. So the same goes in why are things maybe not reported to the police? We must keep in mind that it must be a crime before the police will do anything about it. And then maybe just to confirm on the issue of the auction, I think everyone understands the concern where a debtor might have an asset that can actually solve all the debt problems, but it is sold at such a level, even just at absolute market value, paying off just the bank, because that's the only one that's secured, only creditor secured by the house, and that is actually all they are concerned about. And I think there are measures that we can do, but I also know that we are planning a meeting with the Department of Justice, because when we look, and this is what Treasury also says, where the bank is approached when the debtor starts feeling the crunch, then the bank can step in. They can stop the deduction. They can help the debtor to sell, get money, etc., get a good value for it, so on. But once you start to the process where the house is actually attached and now it's failing execution, then justice plays a role. In fact, they play the role there. And that is then where there needs to be discussion. It's not something that we'll be able to fix by ourselves. So there can be something that we can look at, but that discussion with justice will be very, very important. And I think, Madam Chair, just in general, I do agree with everything the Treasury has said. I think that's explained it quite well.
Thank you very much, Advocate Van der Merwe. Yes, thank you very much, CEO, National Credit Regulator, Ms. Matsugari.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and good day, Honourable Members. I just wanted to say one or two things. In terms of the unsold debt, in instances where banks are selling debt to another creditor, to other credit providers, we normally insist that those credit providers must register with the NCR. As long as they continue to collect on the book, they must be registered with the NCR so that we can continue to monitor that. The question that was asked, or the concern that was raised by Honourable Aldis around, you know, how can we make sure that consumers don't go back, you know, and get themselves into trouble again, you know, once this relief is provided. Other than, you know, doing a thorough consumer behaviour research on this, I think these people, you know, our suggestion would be that they should be flagged somewhere so that claim providers are aware, you know, that these people are, you know, these consumers are they're under debt relief. So, I mean, it's just a suggestion that we discussed as the NCR. The African bank audit, we're almost done with the audit of the bank book, which is RPS, by the way, because it's been, it falls under a different legal entity, residual debt services, I think that's what it's called. But we're almost done with that audit, and we will report back, you know, to the committee once that is completed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We certainly look forward to getting that report back. Let's ask the DDG, Trade and Industry. Yes, thank you, Mr. Nyetsi Tenzi.
No, thanks. Thanks, Chairperson. Mine is I saw the coordination between the departments. As indicated, and then Shamini has already talked about the Department of Justice to say there are certain issues that cannot be concluded without having the Department of Justice as the administrator of the law and probably the enforcers of the law, equally the actionees and the like, self-regulation and the like. So, but I think things are starting to gel by coordinating, and then maybe Parliament would be able to pronounce succinctly what is the way forward.
Thank you very much, Mr. Nyetsi Tenzi. You will see, members, that we have agreed already to ask the Department of Justice to engage with us, but I don't think we've got a date yet, is that correct? We'll confirm a date as soon as we get that. But really, thanks to National Treasury for coming here again. We may need a bit more information that we haven't requested during the meeting, but we will email you on the matter, and I'm sure if you can help, you will do so. And we will keep you in the loop so that when we do begin to finalise things, we've got as much information in order to make the right decision. We're looking at the 9th of June when we have the engagement with National Treasury and the National Credit Regulator in respect of statistics in relation to over-indebtedness. But I can say that we could also then add to that the behavioural processes and responses once debt relief has been applied. So I know that question was raised here. Do we have any understanding of, is there any comparison in other countries? What has been the behaviour of those debtors who were relieved in this manner? Have we got anything to look at in that regard? So if we can, and that applies to both the NCR and National Treasury. Are we clear there? I can't think of any immediate outstanding issue, but if there is, honourable members, please communicate with Mr. Hermans, and of course he'll keep Mr. Williams informed as chairperson of the subcommittee here. There's one thing I ought to add before we do release you and thank you finally, and that is I think it's a matter of serious concern that one of people's significant assets, housing, is dealt with in the current manner in which it is. Even in the West, in the East, no matter where you go, they have separate interest rates when it comes to housing. And they've had a culture of people being able to own their housing, etc., for many decades. Ours is new, and yet we haven't dealt with it yet. So this is an area that we'll have to flag so that we don't allow it again and again to slip under the carpet in the current manner in which it is. And I know that National Treasury is
is also seized with this principle. How do you enable people to retain this important asset that they have? We as yet haven't resolved the land issue, and now we're already getting rid of the housing. It is a problem to me when we look at it. But thank you very much, all of you, again. Committee members, one just needs to remind all members here about the CIPC tomorrow is being launched here in Cape Town. Those who can should come along. I understand it's in 10 Shop 10 Pickbell Arcade, 58 Strand Street. It is near, yes, just past Woolworths, etc. Those who aren't too sure could meet at Portrays at 10 at 9 o'clock and walk together towards the venue itself. Right, so I really think that's important. Again, members, we've been referring to the workshop. And I do think it's now become imperative that this is undertaken. So we are definitely looking at the 27th of June and the 28th. Am I correct? 27th and 28th. On the 29th, I think that if there's anything else outstanding, if there's justice to engage or whatever on the committee bill or any unfinished business in the committee, please keep the 29th, Thursday, retained. Please don't just write it off. I think that's very important. We are going to meet. We just haven't put the issue there. That is so important, members. The final thing is to allow Mr. Hermans to speak to the program, if you would. Just tell them when you'll be issuing it.
Chairperson, based on the changes, I will forward an updated program to members this afternoon. I'll email the updated program.
Right. The other issue is the study visit, is that what it's called? We, overseas, we had initially, you will recall, thought of Croatia, and then realized in many ways we already have the, municipalities being able to deal with indigenous folk there, etc. So there was a need for us to look at other examples where this has been in practice. What was referred to me was Wales, I understand, and we do know that this was done in India, but you had to use your land as collateral. Now, we're not in that happy position. The United States is considered too far away for us to get back into Europe again to go and visit manufacturing plants and the fourth industrial revolution issues. So I think that it would be best if we looked at those two. At one stage we were going to put it together with gambling or whatever. The reality is debt relief is far more important at this time, and so is manufacturing and industrialization. And I think you would understand that. Our request is going to be for 7 people. We probably will only get 5, just so that you are aware. And all of you know how the system works. Depending if it's 7, you get 3 AMC, you get the, is it someone here? 4 AMC, and then it's the DA, the IFP, not the IFP, the EFF, the Economic Freedom Front, etc. fighters, and then of course others. But there is a proviso, and I want you to know that now. It has always applied. If you're not attending committee meetings, you will not be considered. It's as simple as that. All right? So please, let's appreciate that. And is there anyone who continues not to get the emails? because I continue to hear members saying they don't get notices. Who is not getting the notices? You see, everyone is. So we want the notices, we want all of the papers and documentation, and on that particular note, I'd like to thank the committee for their application of their minds to what is here today, and release you. Thank you very much. Meeting adjourned.